Penguin Random House Audio presents The Book of Swords, edited by Gardner Dozois. Read for you by, in order of appearance, Arthur Morey, John Lee, Catherine McEwen, Kim My Guest, Elliot Hill, Steve West, Richard Brewer, Nicholas Guy Smith, Kirby Hayborn, Ralph Lister, Mark Deakins, and Julia Whalen. Introduction by Gardner Dozois. One day in 1963, I stopped in a drugstore on the way home from high school. At that point in time, spinner racks full of mass-market paperbacks in drugstores were one of the few places in our town where books were available. There was no actual bookstore. And spotted on the rack an anthology called The Unknown, edited by D.R. Benson. I picked it up, bought it, and was immediately enthralled by it. It was the first anthology I ever bought, and a purchase that would have a long-term effect on my future career, although I didn't know that at the time. What it was a collection of stories that Benson had culled from the legendary, if short-lived, fantasy magazine Unknown, edited by equally legendary editor John W. Campbell, Jr., who, at about the same time as he was revolutionizing science fiction as the editor of Astounding, was revolutionizing fantasy in the pages of Astounding's sister magazine, Unknown, from 1939 to 1943, when the magazine was killed by wartime paper shortages. In the early 60s, in a decade when the publishing industry was still coming out from under the shadow of post-war grim social realism, there was very little fantasy being published in a format affordable to purchase by a short-of-funds high school student, except for the stories in genre magazines such as The Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, which I didn't know about at the time, and the rich harvest of different types of fantasy story available in Unknown was a revelation to me. The story that had the biggest effect on me, though, was a bizarre, richly atmospheric story called The Bleak Shore by Fritz Leiber, in which two seemingly mismatched adventurers, a giant swordsman from the icy north named Fawford, and a sly, clever, nimble little man from the southern climes called the Grey Mouser, are compelled to go on a doomed mission which seems destined to send them to their death, which fate, however, they cleverly avoid. It was a story unlike anything I'd ever read before, and I immediately wanted to read more stories like that. Fortunately, it wasn't long before I discovered another anthology on the drugstore spinner racks, Swords and Sorcery, edited by L. Sprague de Camp. This one not only containing another Fawford and the Grey Mouser story, but dedicated entirely to the same kind of fantasy story which I learned was called Sword and Sorcery, a name for the subgenre coined by Leiber himself. In the pages of this anthology, I read for the first time one of the adventures of Robert E. Howard's Conan the Barbarian and C. L. Moore's Gerald of Joyrie, as well as stories by Paul Anderson, Lord Dunsany, Clark Ashton Smith, and others. And I was hooked, becoming a lifelong fan of Sword and Sorcery, soon haunting used bookstores in what was then Scully Square in Boston, now buried under the grim mass of Government Center, hunting through piles of moldering old pulp magazines for back issues of Unknown and Weird Tales that featured stories of Conan the Barbarian and Fawford and the Grey Mouser and other swashbuckling heroes. What I had blundered into was the first great revival of interest in sword and sorcery, a subgenre of fantasy that had at that point lain fallow for decades, with almost all of the material in those anthologies and those old pulp magazines having been published in the 30s or 40s or even earlier, about the time that stories that took place in distinct fantasy worlds, instead of 17th century France or imaginary Central European countries, began to precipitate out from the larger and older body of work about swashbuckling, sword-swinging adventurers written by authors such as Alexandre Dumas, Raphael Sabatini, Talbot Mundy, and Harold Lamb. After Edgar Rice Burroughs in A Princess of Mars and its many sequels sent adventurer John Carter to his own version of Mars called Barsoom to rescue princesses and have sword fights with giant four-armed tharks, a closely parallel form to sword and sorcery, sometimes called planetary romance or sword and planet stories developed, most prominently in the pages of pulp magazine Planet Stories between 1939 and 1955, with the two subgenres exchanging influences and even many of the same authors, including authors such as C.L. Moore and Lee Brackett, who were highly influential in both forms. The richly colored tales that made up Jack Vance's classic The Dying Earth, also published about then, were also technically science fiction, but with their interdimensional intrusions, strange creatures, and mages who wielded what could either be looked at as magic or the highest of high technology, they could also function as fantasy as well. Probably not coincidentally, interest in sword and sorcery, which had faded over the wartime years and throughout the 50s, began to revive in the 60s, after the Mariner and Venera and other space probes were making it increasingly obvious that the rest of the solar system was incapable of supporting life as we knew it. No ferocious warriors to have sword fights with, or beautiful princesses in diaphanous gowns to romance. Nothing but airless balls of barren rock. From now on, if you wanted to tell those kinds of stories, you were going to have to do it in fantasy. Throughout the early 60s, sword and sorcery boomed with D.R. Benson, L. Sprague de Camp, and Leo Margulies mining the rich loads of Unknown and Weird Tales magazines for other anthologies. Benson, an important figure in the development of modern fantasy, now sadly mostly forgotten, was the editor of Pyramid Books, and also mined the pages of Unknown for classic fantasy novels such as de Camp and Fletcher Pratt's The Incomplete Enchanter and The Castle of Iron to reprint. Collections of the original Conan stories being reissued, new Conan stories and novels being produced by other hands, Michael Moorcock producing his hugely popular stories and novels about Elric of Melna Bonnae, which have continued to the present day, and obvious imitations of Conan such as John Jakes's Brack the Barbarian stories being turned out. At about this time, Selle Goldsmith, the editor of Amazing and Fantastic magazines, began to coax Fritz Leiber out of semi-retirement and got him to write new Fawford and the Grey Mouser stories for Fantastic, which, once I noticed that, induced me to begin regularly picking a genre magazine up off the newsstands for the first time, which in turn induced me to begin buying science fiction magazines such as Amazing, Galaxy, and Worlds of If, which means that, ironically, although I'd later become associated with science fiction and would edit the science fiction magazine myself, I came to them first because I was looking for more Fawford and the Grey Mouser stories in the pages of a fantasy magazine. Although, to be fair, I was at the same time reading science fiction such as the Robert A. Heinlein and Andre Norton juveniles, and stuff such as Hal Clement's Cycle of Fire, and, also published by Pyramid Books, Mission of Gravity. Then came J.R.R. Tolkien. J.R.R. Tolkien's The Lord of the Rings trilogy is often cited these days as having single-handedly created the modern fantasy genre, but while it is certainly hard to overestimate Tolkien's influence, almost every subsequent fantasist was hugely influenced by Tolkien, even, haplessly, those who didn't like him and reacted against him. What is sometimes forgotten these days is that Don Wolheim published the infamous pirated edition of The Fellowship of the Ring, the opening book of the trilogy, as an ace paperback in the first place, because he was casting desperately around for something, anything, with which to feed the hunger of the swelling audience for sword and sorcery. The cover art of the ace edition of The Fellowship of the Ring, by Jack Gaughan, of a wizard waving a sword and a staff aloft on top of a mountain, makes it clear that Wolheim thought of it as a sword and sorcery book, and his signed interior copy makes that explicit by touting the Tolkien volume as a book of sword and sorcery that anyone can read with delight and pleasure. In other words, in the United States at least, the genre audience for fantasy definitely predated Tolkien rather than being created by him, as the modern myth would have it. Don Wolheim knew very well that there was a genre fantasy audience already out there, already in place, a hungry audience waiting to be fed, although I doubt if even he had the remotest idea just how tremendous a response there would be to the tidbit of sword and sorcery that he was about to feed them. The Tolkien novels had already appeared in expensive hardcover editions in Britain, but the Ace paperback editions, and the authorized paperback editions that followed from Ballantine Books, made them available for the first time in editions that kids like me and millions of others could afford to buy. After Tolkien, everything changed. The audience for genre fantasy may have already existed, but there can be no doubt that Tolkien widened it tremendously. The immense commercial success of Tolkien's work also opened the eyes of other publishers to the fact that there was an intense hunger for fantasy in the reading audience, and they too began looking around for something to feed that hunger. On the strength of Tolkien's success, Lynn Carter was able to create the first mass-market paperback fantasy line, the Ballantine Adult Fantasy Line, which brought back into print long-forgotten and long-unavailable works by writers such as Clark Ashton Smith, E.R. Edison, James Branch Cabell, Mervyn Peake, and Lord Dunsany. A few years later, Lester Del Rey took over from Lynn Carter and began to search for more commercial, less high-toned stuff that would appeal more directly to an audience still hungry for something as much like Tolkien as possible. In 1974, he brought out Terry Brooks's The Sword of Shannara, and although it was dismissed by many critics as a clumsy retread of Tolkien, it proved hugely successful commercially, as did its many sequels. In 1977, Del Rey also scored big with Lord Foulsbane, the beginning of the somewhat quirkier and less derivative trilogy, The Chronicles of Thomas Covenant the Unbeliever, by Stephen R. Donaldson, and its many sequels. Oddly, as fantasy books began to sell better by far than ever before, interest in sword and sorcery began to fade. Sword and sorcery had always been a subgenre mostly driven by short fiction, but inspired by Tolkien, the new fantasy novels began to get longer and longer and spawn more and more sequels, and now began to be largely thought of as a distinct subgenre, epic fantasy. It's sometimes difficult for me to make a distinction between epic fantasy and sword and sorcery. Both are set in invented fantasy worlds. Both have thieves and sword-wielding adventurers. Both take place in worlds in which magic exists and there are sorcerers of greater or lesser potency. Both feature fantasy creatures such as dragons and giants and monsters. Although some critics say they can distinguish one from the other by criteria other than length. Be that as it may, as books thought of as epic fantasy became more and more prominent, people talked less about sword and sorcery. It never disappeared entirely. Lynn Carter edited 5 volumes of the Flashing Swords anthology series between 1971 and 1981. Andrew J. Offutt, Jr. edited 5 volumes of the Swords Against Darkness anthology series between 1977 and 1979. Robert Lynn Asprin started the long-running series of Thieves' World shared world anthologies in 1978. Robert Jordan produced a long sequence of Conan novels throughout the 80s before turning to his multi-volume Wheel of Time epic fantasy series. Glenn Cook produced recognizable sword and sorcery work, notably his tales about the Black Company, throughout the same period, as did C.J. Cherry, Robin Hobb, Fred Saberhagen, Kenneth Lee, Carl Edward Wagner, and others. Marion Zimmer Bradley edited a long sequence of sword and sorceress anthologies with the emphasis on female adventurers throughout the 70s, and Jessica Amanda Samuelson produced a similarly female-oriented set of anthologies, Amazons and Amazons 2, in 1979 and 1982, respectively. Nevertheless, as the 80s progressed into the 90s, sword and sorcery continued to fade as a subgenre, until it was rarely ever mentioned and was in danger of being altogether forgotten. Then, at the end of the 90s, things began to turn around. Why they did is difficult to pinpoint. Perhaps it was the enormous commercial success of George R.R. Martin's A Game of Thrones, published in 1996, and its sequels, which influenced newer writers by showing them a grittier, more realistic, harder-edged kind of epic fantasy, one with characters who were often so morally ambiguous that it was impossible to tell the good guys from the bad guys. Perhaps it was just time for a new generation of writers, who had been influenced by the classic work of writers like Leiber and Howard and Moorcock, to take the stage and produce their own new variations on the form. Whatever the reason, the ice began to thaw. Soon people began to talk about the new sword and sorcery, and in the last few years of the 20th century and the early years of the 21st century, there were writers such as Joe Abercrombie, K.J. Parker, Scott Lynch, Elizabeth Baer, Stephen Erickson, Garth Nix, Patrick Rothfuss, Kate Elliott, Daniel Abraham, Brandon Sanderson, and James Ang, making names for themselves. There were new markets in addition to existing ones, such as F and SF for sword and sorcery, such as the online magazine Beneath Ceaseless Skies, and print magazine Black Gate, and new anthologies began to appear, such as my own Modern Classics of Fantasy in 1997, which featured classic sword and sorcery stories by Fritz Leiber and Jack Vance. The Sword and Sorcery Anthology, edited by David G. Hartwell and Jacob Weissman, a retrospective of some of the best old stories of the form, and Epic, Legends of Fantasy, edited by John Joseph Adams, an anthology reprinting newer work by newer authors. Most importantly, new short work began to appear, collected in anthologies such as Legends and Legends 2, edited by Robert Silverberg, and later in Fast Ships, Black Sails, edited by Ann Vandermeer and Jeff Vandermeer, and Swords and Dark Magic, The New Sword and Sorcery, edited by Jonathan Strahan and Lou Anders, the first dedicated anthology of the new sword and sorcery. All at once, we were in the middle of another great revival of interest in sword and sorcery, one which has so far not faded again as we progress deeper into the second decade of the 21st century. Already there's another generation of newer writers such as Ken Liu, Rich Larson, Kerry Vaughan, Aliette de Baudard, Lavi Tidhar, and others, taking up the challenges of the form and sometimes evolving it in unexpected directions. And behind them are yet more new generations. So, call it sword and sorcery, or call it epic fantasy, it looks like this kind of story is going to be around for a while for us to enjoy. I've edited other anthologies with new sword and sorcery stories in them, such as the Jack Vance tribute anthology, Songs of the Dying Earth, Warriors, Dangerous Women, and Rogues, all edited with that other big-time sword and sorcery fan, George R.R. Martin. But I've always wanted to edit an anthology of nothing but such stories, which is what I've done here with The Book of Swords, bringing you the best work of some of the best writers working in the form today from across several different literary generations. I hope that you enjoy it. And it's my hope that to some young kid out there, it will prove as enthralling and inspirational as Unknown and Swords and Sorcery did to me back in 1963. And so a new sword and sorcery fan will be born to carry the love of this kind of swashbuckling fantasy tale on into the distant future. K.J. Parker. One of the most inventive and imaginative writers working in fantasy today, K.J. Parker is the author of the best-selling Engineer trilogy, Devices and Desires, Evil for Evil, The Escapement, as well as the previous Fencer, The Colors in the Steel, The Belly of the Bow, The Proof House, and Scavenger, Shadow, Pattern, Memory, trilogies. His short fiction has been collected in Academic Exercises, and he has twice won the World Fantasy Award for Best Novella for Let Maps to Others and A Small Price to Pay for Birdsong. His other novels include Sharps, The Company, The Folding Knife, and The Hammer. His most recent novels are Savages and The Two of Swords. K.J. Parker also writes under his real name, Tom Holt. As Holt, he has published Expecting Someone Taller, Who's Afraid of Beowulf, Ye Gods, and many other novels. Here, he gives us a compelling look at a determined pupil seeking out a master for instruction, with some surprising results.
The Best Man Wins by K.J. Parker. He was in my light. I didn't look up. "What do you want?" I said. "Excuse me, but are you the swordsmith?" There are certain times when you have to concentrate. This was one of them. "Yes, go away and come back later." "I haven't told you what I..." "Go away and come back later." He went away. I finished what I was doing. He came back later. In the interim, I did the third fold. Forge welding is a horrible procedure, and I hate doing it. In fact, I hate doing all the many stages that go to creating the finished object. Some of them are agonizingly difficult. Some are exhausting. Some of them are very, very boring. A lot of them are all three. It's your perfect microcosm of human endeavor. What I love is the feeling you get when you've done them and they've come out right. Nothing in the whole wide world beats that. The third fold is, well, it's the stage in making a sword blade, when you fold the material for the third time. The first fold is just a lot of thin rods, some iron, some steel, twisted together, then heated white, and forged into a single strip of thick ribbon. Then you twist, fold, and do it again. Then you twist, fold, and do it again. The third time is usually the easiest. The materials had most of the rubbish beaten out of it. The flux usually stays put, and the work seems to flow that bit more readily under the hammer. It's still a horrible job. It seems to take forever, and you can wreck everything you've done so far with one split second of carelessness. If you burn it, or let it get too cold, or if a bit of scale or slag gets hammered in. You need to listen, as well as look, for that unique hissing noise that tells you that the material is just starting to spoil, but isn't actually ruined yet. That's the only moment at which one strip of steel will flow into another and form a single piece. So you can't chat while you're doing it. Since I spend most of my working day forge welding, I have this reputation for unsociability. Not that I mind. I'd be unsociable if I were a plowman. He came back when I was shoveling charcoal. I can talk and shovel at the same time, so that was all right. He was young, I'd say about 23 or 4. A tall bastard. All tall people are bastards. I'm 5'2". With curly blonde hair like a wet fleece, a flat face, washed out blue eyes, and a rather girly mouth. I took against him at first sight because I don't like tall, pretty men. I put a lot of stock in first impressions. My first impressions are nearly always wrong. "What do you want?" I said.
"I'd like to buy a sword, please."
I didn't like his voice much, either. In that crucial first 5 seconds or so, voices are even more important to me than looks. Perfectly reasonable, if you ask me. Some princes look like rat catchers, some rat catchers look like princes, though the teeth usually give people away. But you can tell precisely where a man comes from and how well off his parents were after a couple of words. Hard data. Genuine facts. The boy was quality, minor nobility, which covers everything from overambitious farmers to the younger brothers of dukes. You can tell immediately by the vowel sounds. They set my teeth on edge like bits of grit in bread. I don't like the nobility much. Most of my customers are nobility, and most of the people I meet are customers. "Of course you do," I said, straightening my back and laying the shovel down on the edge of the forge. "What do you want it for?" He looked at me as though I'd just leered at his sister.
"Well, For fighting with?
I nodded. Off to the wars, are you?
At some stage, probably, yes.
I wouldn't if I were you, I said, and I made a point of looking him up and down thoroughly and deliberately. It's a horrible life, and it's dangerous. I'd stay home if I were you. Make yourself useful. I like to see how they take it. Call it my craftsman's instinct. To give you an example, one of the things you do to test a really good sword is make it come compass. You fix the tang in a vise. Then you bend it right round in a circle until the point touches the shoulders. Let it go, and it should spring back absolutely straight. Most perfectly good swords won't take that sort of abuse. It's an ordeal you reserve for the very best. It's a horrible, cruel thing to do to a lovely artifact, and it's the only sure way to prove its temper. Talking of temper, he stared at me, then shrugged.
I'm sorry, he said. You're busy. I'll try somewhere else.
I laughed. Let me see to this fire and I'll be right with you. The fire rules my life, like a mother and her baby. It has to be fed or it goes out. It has to be watered, splashed round the edge of the bed with a ladle, or it'll burn the bed of the forge. It has to be pumped after every heat, so I do all its breathing for it, and you can't turn your back on it for 2 minutes. From the moment when I light it in the morning, an hour before sunrise, until the point where I leave it to starve itself to death overnight, it's constantly in my mind, like something at the edge of your vision, or a crime on your conscience. You're not always looking at it, but you're always watching it. Given half a chance, it'll betray you. Sometimes I think I'm married to the damn thing. Indeed, I never had time for a wife. I've had offers, not from women, but from their fathers and brothers. He must be worth a bob or two, they say to themselves, and our Doria's not getting any younger. But a man with a forge fire can't fit a wife into his daily routine. I bake my bread in its embers, toast my cheese over it, warm a kettle of water twice a day to wash in, dry my shirts next to it. Some nights, when I'm too worn out to struggle the 10 yards to my bed, I sit on the floor with my back to it and go to sleep, and wake up in the morning with a cricked neck and a headache. The reason we don't quarrel all the time is that it can't speak. It doesn't need to. The fire and I have lived sociably together for 20 years, ever since I came back from the wars. 20 years. In some jurisdictions, you get less for murder. The term sword, I said, wiping dust and embers off the table with my sleeve, can mean a lot of different things. I need you to be more specific. Sit down. He perched gingerly on the bench. I poured cider into 2 wooden bowls and put one down in front of him. There was dust floating on the top. There always is. Everything in my life comes with a frosting of dark grey, gritty dust, courtesy of the fire. Bless him. He did his best to pretend it wasn't there and took a little sip. Like a girl. There's your short riding sword, I said, and your 30-inch arming sword, your sword and shield sword, which is either a constant flattened diamond section, what the army calls a type 15, or else, with a half-length fuller, your type 14. There's your tuck, your falchion, your messer side sword or hanger. There's your long sword, great sword, hand and a half, type 18, true bastard. Your great sword of war and your proper two-hander. Though that's a highly specialized tool, so you won't be wanting one of them. And those are just the main headings, which is why I asked you. What do you want it for? He looked at me, then deliberately drank a swallow of my horrible, dusty cider.
For fighting with, he said. Sorry, I don't know very much about it.
Have you got any money? He nodded, put his hand up inside his shirt and pulled out a little linen bag. It was dirty with sweat. He opened it and 5 gold coins spilled onto my table. There are almost as many types of coin as there are types of sword. These were bezants, 92 parts fine, guaranteed by the emperor. I picked one up. The artwork on a bezant is horrible, crude, and ugly. That's because the design stayed the same for 600 years. copied over and over again by ignorant and illiterate die-cutters. It stays the same because it's trusted. They copy the lettering, but they don't know their letters, so you just get shapes. It's a good general rule, in fact. The prettier the coin, the less gold it contains. The uglier, conversely, the better. I knew a forger once. They caught him and hanged him because his work was too fine. I put my cup on top of one coin, then pushed the other four back at him. All right? He shrugged. I want the very best. It'd be wasted on you. Even so. Fine. The very best is what you get. After all, once you're dead, it'll move on. Sooner or later, it'll end up with someone who'll be able to use it. I grinned at him. Most likely your enemy. He smiled. You mean I'll reward him for killing me? The laborer is worthy of his hire, I replied. Right, since you haven't got a clue what you want, I'll have to decide for you. For your gold bezant, you'll get a long sword. Do you know what that...
No, sorry.
I scratched my ear. Blade 3 feet long, I said. 2.5 inches wide at the hilt, tapering straight to a needle point. The handle as long as your forearm, from the inside of your elbow to the tip of your middle finger. Weight absolutely no more than 3 pounds, and it'll feel a good deal lighter than that because I'll balance it perfectly. It'll be a stabber more than a cutter because it's the point that wins fights, not the edge. I strongly recommend a fuller. You don't know what a fuller is, do you?
No.
Well, you're getting one anyway. Will that do you? He sort of gazed at me as if I were the moon.
I want the best sword ever made, he said. I can pay more if necessary.
The best sword ever made. The silly thing was, I could do it, if I could be bothered. Or I could make him the usual and tell him it was the best sword ever made, and how could he possibly ever know? There are maybe 10 men in the world qualified to judge, me and 9 others. On the other hand, I love my craft. Here was a young fool saying, indulge yourself at my expense. And the work, of course, the sword itself, would still be alive in 1,000 years' time, venerated and revered, with my name on the hilt. The best ever made. And if I didn't do it, someone else would, and it wouldn't be my name on it. I thought for a moment, then leant forward, put my fingertips on 2 more of his coins, and dragged them towards me, like a plowshare through clay. All right. He shrugged.
You know about these things?
I nodded. In fact, I said, and took a 4th coin. He didn't move. It was as though he wasn't interested. That's just for the plain sword, I said. I don't do polishing, engraving, carving, chiseling, or inlay. I don't set jewels in hilts because they chafe your hands raw and fall out. I don't even make scabbards. You can have it tarted up later if you want, but that's up to you.
The plain sword will do me just fine, he said.
Which puzzled me. I have a lot of experience of the nobility. This one. His voice was exactly right, so I could vouch for him, as though I'd known him all my life. The clothes were plain, good quality, old but well looked after, a nice pair of boots, though I'd have said they were a size too big, so maybe inherited. 5 bezants is a vast, stunning amount of money, but I got the impression it was all he had. Let me guess, I said. Your father died, and your elder brother got the house and the land. Your portion was 5 gold bits. You accept that that's how it's got to be, but you're bitter. You think, I'll blow the lot on the best sword ever made and go off and carve myself out a fortune, like Robert the Fox or Bohemond. Something like that? A very slight nod.
Something like that?
Fine, I said. A certain category of people and their money are easily parted. If you live long enough to get some sense beaten into you, you'll get rather more than 4 gold bits for the sword, and then you can buy a nice farm.
He smiled. That's all right, then.
I like people who take no notice when I'm rude to them. Can I watch? He asked. That's a question that could get you in real trouble, depending on context. Like the man and woman you've just thought of, my answer is usually no. If you like, I said. Yes. Why not? You can be a witness.
He frowned. That's an odd choice of word.
Like a prophet in scripture, I said. When he turns water into wine, or raises the dead, or recites the law out of a burning tree. There has to be someone on hand to see, or what's the good in it? I remembered saying that later. Now he nodded.
A miracle.
Along those lines. But a miracle is something you didn't expect to happen. Off to the wars. We talk about the wars as though it's a place. Leave Perimedea on the north road till you reach a crossroads. Bear left, take the next right, just past the old ruined mill. You can't miss it. At the very least, a country with its own language, customs, distinctive national dress, and regional delicacies. But in theory, every war is different, as individual and unique as a human being. Each war has parents that influence it, but grows up to follow its own nature and beget its own offspring. But we talk about people en masse. The Elians, the Mesentines, the Rosenholet, as though a million disparate entities can be combined into one, the way I twist and hammer a faggot of iron rods into a single ribbon. And when you look at them, the wars are like that, like a crowd of people. When you're standing among them, they're all different. Step back 300 yards and all you see is one shape. An army, say, advancing toward you. We call that shape the enemy. It's the dragon we have to kill in order to prevail and be heroes. By the time it reaches us, it's delaminated into individuals, into one man at a time, rushing at us waving a spear, out to do us harm, absolutely terrified, just as we are. We say the wars, but here's a secret. There is only one war. It's never over. It flows like the metal at white heat under the hammer, and joins up with the last war and the next war to form one continuous ribbon. My father went to the wars. I went to the wars. My son will go to the wars, and his son after him, and it'll be the same place. Like going to Bok Bahek. My father went there before they pulled down the White Temple, and when Foregate was still open fields. I went there, and Foregate was a marketplace. When my son goes there, they'll have built houses on Foregate, but the place will still be Bok Bahek, and the war will still be the war. Same place, same language and local customs, slightly altered by the prevailing fashions in valor and misery, which come around and go around. In my time at the wars, hilts were curved and pommels were round or teardrop. These days I do mostly straight cross hilts and scent bottle pommels, which were all the rage 100 years ago. There are fashions in everything. The tides go in and out, but the sea is always the sea. My wars were in Ultramar, which isn't a place name, it's just Ilian for across the sea. Ultramar, which was what we were fighting for, wasn't a piece of land, a geographical entity. It was an idea, the kingdom of God on earth. You won't find it on a map. Not now, that's for sure. We lost, and all the places we used to know are called something else now, in another language, which we could never be bothered to learn. We weren't there for the idea, of course, although it was probably a good one at the time. We were there to rob ourselves a fortune and go home princes. Some places aren't marked on maps, and everybody knows how to find them. Just follow the others, and you're there. There's not a lot to see at this stage, I told him. You might want to go away for a while.
That's all right.
He sat down on the spare anvil and bit into one of my apples, which I hadn't given him.
What are you doing with all that junk? I thought you were going to start on the sword.
I told myself, he's paying a lot of money. Probably everything he's got in the world. He's entitled to be stupid if he wants to. This, I told him, isn't junk. It's your sword. He peered over my shoulder.
No, it's not. It's a load of old horseshoes and some clapped-out files.
It is now, yes.
You just watch.
I don't know what it is about old horseshoes. Nobody does. Most people reckon it's the constant bashing down on the stony ground, though that's just not true. but horseshoes make the best swords. I heated them to just over cherry red, flipped them onto the anvil, and belted them with the big hammer, flattening and drawing down. Bits of rust and scale shot across the shop. It's a messy job, and it's got to be done quickly, before the iron cools to grey. By the time I'd finished with them, they were long, squarish rods, about a quarter inch thick. I put them on one side, then did the same for the files. They're steel, the stuff that you can harden. The horseshoes are iron, which stays soft. It's the mix, the weave of hard and soft that makes a good blade.
What are they supposed to be, then? Skewers?
I'd forgotten he was there. Patient, I'll say that for him. I'll be at this for hours yet. I told him, why don't you go away and come back in the morning? Nothing interesting to see till then.
He yawned. I've got nowhere in particular to go.
He said, I'm not bothering you, am I?
No,
I lied. I still don't see what those bits of stick have got to do with my sword. What the hell? I could use a rest. It's a bad idea to work when you're tired. You make mistakes. I tipped a scuttle of charcoal onto the fire, damped it down, and sat on the swedge block. Where do you think steel comes from?
He scratched his head. Permia?
Not such an ignorant answer. In Permia, there are deposits of natural steel. You crush the iron ore and smelt it, and genuine hardening steel oozes out, all ready to use. But it's literally worth its weight in gold, and since we're at war with Permia, it's hard to get hold of. Besides, I find it's too brittle, unless you temper it exactly right. Steel, I told him, is iron that's been forged out over and over again in a charcoal fire. Nobody has the faintest idea how it works, but it does. It takes two strong men a whole day to make enough steel for one small file.
He shrugged. It's expensive. So what?
And it's too hard. I told him, drop it on the floor, it'll shatter like glass. So you temper it. So it'll bend, then spring back straight. But it's sulky stuff. Good for chisels and files. Not so good for swords and scythe blades, which want a bit of bounce in them. So we weave it together with iron, which is soft and forgiving. Iron and steel cancel out each other's faults, and you get what you want. He looked at me. Weave together. I nodded. Watch. You take your five rods and lay them side by side, touching. Steel, iron, steel, iron, steel. You wire them tightly together, like building a raft. You lay them in the fire, edge downwards, not flat. When they're white hot and starting to hiss like a snake, you pull them out and hammer them. If you've got it right, you get showers of white sparks, and you can actually see the metal weld together. It's a sort of black shadow under the glowing white surface, flowing like a liquid. What it is, I don't know, and not being inclined to mysticism, I prefer not to speculate. Then you heat the flat plate you've just made to yellow, grip one end in the vise, and twist your plate into a rope, which you then forge flat. Heat and twist and flatten, five times isn't too many. If you've done it right, you have a straight flat bar, inch wide, quarter inch thick, with no trace of a seam or laminations, one solid thing from five. Then you heat it up and draw it out, fold it and weld it again. Now you can see why I talk about weaving. There is no more iron or steel. No power on earth will ever separate them again. But the steel is still hard and the iron is still yielding. And that's what makes the finished blade come compass in the vise, if you're prepared to take the risk. I lose track of time when I'm forge welding. I stop when it's done and not before. And I realize how tired and wet with sweat and thirsty I am, and how many hot zits and cinders have burnt their way through my clothes and blistered my skin. The joy isn't in the doing, but the having done. You weld in the near dark, so you can see what's going on in the heart of the fire and the hot metal. I looked to where I know the doorway is, but it was all pitch dark outside the orange ring of firelight. It's just as well I have no neighbors, or they'd get no sleep. He was asleep, though, in spite of all the noise. I nudged his foot, and he sat up straight.
Did I miss something?
Yes.
Oh,
but that's all right, I said. We've barely started yet. Logic dictates that I had a life before I went to Ultramar. I must have had. I was 19 when I went there, 26 when I came back. Before I went there, I seemed to recall a big comfortable house in a valley, and dogs and hawks and horses, and a father and two elder brothers. They may all still be there, for all I know. I've never been back. 7 years in Ultramar. Most of us didn't make it past the first 6 months. A very few, the file, hard, unkillable sort, survived as long as 3 years, by which point you could almost see the marks where the wind and rain had worn them down to bedrock, or the riverbeds and salt stalactites on their cheeks. They were old, old men, the three-year boys, and not one of them over 25. I did 3 years and immediately signed on for another three, then another three after that, of which I served one. Then I was sent home, in disgrace. Nobody ever gets sent home from Ultramar, which is where the judge sends you if you've murdered someone and hanging is too good for you. They need every man they can get, and they use them up at a stupid rate, like a farmer with his winter fodder in a very bad year. They say that the enemy collects our bones from the battlefields and grinds them down for bone meal, which is how come they have such excellent wheat harvests. The usual punishment for really unforgivable crimes in Ultramar is a tour of duty at the front. You have to prove genuine extenuating circumstances and show deep remorse to get the noose instead. Me, though, they sent home, in disgrace, because nobody could bear the sight of me a moment longer. And to be fair, I can't say I blame them. I don't sleep much. The people in the village say it's because I have nightmares, but really I simply don't find the time. Once you've started welding, you don't stop. Once you've welded the core, you want to get on and do the edges. Then you want to weld the edges to the core. Then the job's done, and there's some new pest nagging you to start the next one. I tend to sleep when I'm tired, which is roughly every 4 days. In case your heart is bleeding for me, when the job's done and I get paid, I throw the money in an old barrel I brought back from the wars. I think originally it contained arrowheads. Anyway, I have no idea how much is in there, but it's about half full. I do all right. Like I told you, I lose track of time when I'm working. Also, I forget about things, such as people. I clean forgot about the boy for a whole day. But when I remembered him, he was still there, perched on the spare anvil, his face black with dust and soot. He tied a bit of rag over his nose and mouth, which was fine by me since it stopped him talking. "Haven't you got anything better to do?" I asked. "No, not really." He yawned and stretched. "I think I'm starting to get the hang of this. Basically, it's the idea that a lot of strands woven together are stronger than just one, like the body politic." "Have you had anything to eat recently, since you stole my apple?" He shook his head. "Not hungry." "Have you got any money for food?" He smiled. "I've got a whole gold bezant. I could buy a farm."
"Not around here."
"Yes. Well, it's prime arable land. Where I come from, you could buy a whole valley." I sighed.
"There's bread and cheese indoors," I said, "and a side of bacon." At least that got rid of him for a bit, and I closed up the fold and decided I needed a rest. I'd been staring at white-hot metal for rather too long, and I could barely see past all the pretty shining colors. He came back with half a loaf and all my cheese.
"Have some," he said, like he owned the place.
I don't talk with my mouth full. It's rude. So I waited till I'd finished.
"So where are you from, then?"
"Finn Mohawk. Heard of it?"
"It's a fair-sized town.
10 miles north of Finn, to be exact."
"I knew a man from Finn once."
"In Ultramar?" I frowned.
"Who told you that?"
"Someone in the village."
I nodded. "Nice part of the world, the Mohawk Valley."
"If you're a sheep, maybe."
"And we weren't in the valley, we were up on the moor. It's all heather and granite outcrops."
"I've been there."
"So,"
I said, "you left home to seek your fortune."
"Hardly."
He spat something out, probably a hard bit of bacon rind. You can break your teeth on that stuff.
"I'd go back like a shot if there were anything left for me there."
Where were you in Ultramar, precisely?
Oh, all over the place, I said. So if you like the Mohawk so much, why did you leave?
To come here. To see you. To buy a sword.
A decidedly forced grin.
Why else?
What do you need a sword for in the Mohawk Hills?
I'm not going to use it there.
The words had come out in a rush, like beer spilt when some fool jostles your arm in the taproom. He took a deep breath, then went on.
At least, I don't imagine I will.
Really? He nodded.
I'm going to use it to kill the man who murdered my father, and I don't think he lives round here.
I got into this business by accident. That is, I got off the boat from Ultramar, and 50 yards from the dock was a forge. I had 1 thaler and 5 copper stivers in my pocket, the clothes I'd worn under my armor for the last 2 years, and a sword worth 20 gold angels that I'd never sell under any circumstances. I walked over to the forge and offered to give the smith the 1 thaler, if he taught me his trade.
Get lost, he said.
People don't talk to me like that. So I spent the 1 thaler on a third-hand anvil, a selection of unsuitable hammers, a rasp, a leg vice, and a bucket. And I lugged that damned anvil around with me, 300 weight, until I found a half-derelict shed out back of a tannery. I offered the tanner 3 stivers for rent, bought a stiver's worth of rusty files and 2 barley loaves, and taught myself the trade, with the intention of putting the other smith out of business within a year. In the event, it took me 6 months. I grant you, I knew a little bit more about the trade than the foregoing implies. I'd sat in the smithy at home on cold mornings and watched our man there, and I picked things up quickly. Also, you learn to do all sorts of things in Ultramar, particularly skills pertaining to repairing or improvising equipment, most of which we got from the enemy, with holes in it. When I decided to specialize, it was a toss-up whether I was going to be a swordsmith or an armorer. Literally, I flipped a coin for it. I lost the toss, and here I am. Did I mention that I have my own water wheel? I built it myself, and I'm ridiculously proud of it. I based it on one I saw, inspected, then set fire to in Ultramar. It's overshot, with a 12-foot throw, and it runs off a stream that comes tumbling and bouncing down the hill and over a sheer cliff where the hillside's fallen away. It powers my grindstone and my trip hammer, the only trip hammer north of the Vossen, also built by me. I'm a clever bugger. You can't forge weld with a trip hammer. You need to be able to see what you're doing and feel the metal flowing into itself. At least, I can't. I'm not perfect. But it's ideal for working the finished material down into shape. Takes all the effort out of it, though by God you have to concentrate. A light touch is what you need. The hammerhead weighs 0.5 ton. I've had so much practice I can use it to break the shell on a boiled egg. I also made spring swedges for putting in fullers and profiling the edges of the blade. You can call it cheating if you like. I prefer to call it precision and perfection. Thanks to the trip hammer and the swedges, I get straight, even, flat, incrementally distal tapered sword blades that don't curl up like corkscrews when you harden and quench them, because every blow of the hammer is exactly the same strength as the previous one, and the swedges allow no scope for human error, such as you inevitably get trying to judge it all by eye. If I were inclined to believe in gods, I think I'd probably worship the trip hammer, even though I made it myself. Reasons? First, it's so much stronger than I am, or any man living, and tireless, and those are essential qualities for a god. It sounds like a god. It drowns out everything, and you can't hear yourself think. Second, it's a creator. It shapes things, turns strips and bars of raw material into recognizable objects with a use and a life of their own. Third, and most significant, it rains down blows tirelessly, overwhelmingly. It strikes twice in the time it takes my heart to beat once. It's a smiter, and that's what gods do, isn't it? They hammer and hammer and keep on hammering till either you're swaged into shape or you're a bloody pulp.
Is that it? He said.
I could tell he wasn't impressed. It's not finished. It has to be ground first.
My grindstone is as tall as I am, a flat, round sandstone cheese. The river turns it, which is just as well because I couldn't. You have to be very careful, with the most delicate touch. It eats metal and heats it too. So if your concentration wanders for a split second, you've drawn the temper and the sword will bend like a strip of lead. But I'm a real artist with a grindstone. I wrap a scarf 3 times round my nose and mouth to keep the dust from choking me, and wear thick gloves. Because if you touch the stone when it's running full tilt, it'll take your skin off down to the bone before you can flinch away. When you're grinding, you're the eye of a storm of white and gold sparks. They burn your skin and set your shirt on fire. But you can't let little things like that distract you. Everything I do takes total concentration. Probably that's why I do this job. I don't do fancy finishes. I say, if you want a mirror, buy a mirror. But my blades take and keep an edge you can shave with, and they come compass. Is this strictly necessary? He asked, as I clamped the tang in the vise. No, I said, and reached for the wrench. Only if you break it, you'll have to start again from scratch, and I want to get on. The best ever made, I reminded him, and he gave me a grudging nod. For that job, I use a scroll monkey. It's a sort of massive fork you use for bending scroll work, if that's your idea of a useful and productive life. It takes every last drop of my strength, and I'm no weakling, all to perform a test that might well wreck the thing that's been my life and soul for the last 10 days and nights, which the customer barely appreciates, and which makes me feel sick to my stomach. But it has to be done. You bend the blade until the tip touches the jaw of the vise, then you gently let it go back. Out it comes from the vise, and you lay it on the perfectly straight, flat bed of the anvil. You get down on your knees, looking for a tiny hair of light between the edge of the blade and the anvil. If you see it, the blade goes in the scrap. Here, I said, come and look for yourself. He got down beside me. What am I looking for, exactly? Nothing. It isn't there. That's the point. Can I get up now, please? Perfectly straight. So straight that not even light can squeeze through the gap. I hate all the steps on the way to perfection, the effort and the noise and the heat and the dust, but when you get there, you're glad to be alive. I slid the hilt, grip, and pommel down over the tang, fixed the blade in the vise, and peened the end of the tang into a neat little button. Then I took the sword out of the vise and offered it to him, hilt first. All done, I said. Finished? Finished. All yours. I remember one kid I made a sword for, an earl's son, 7 feet tall and strong as a bull. I handed him his finished sword. He took a good grip on the hilt, then swung it round his head and brought it down full power on the horn of the anvil. It bit a chunk out, then bounced back a foot in the air, the edge undamaged. So I punched him halfway across the room. You clown, I said. Look what you've done to my anvil. When he got up, he was in tears. But I forgave him years later. There's a thrill when you hold a good sword for the first time. It sort of tugs at your hands like a dog wanting to be taken for a walk. You want to swish it about and hit things with it. At the very least, you do a few cuts and wards on the pretext of checking the balance and the handling. He just took it from me as though I'd given him a shopping list. Thanks, he said. My pleasure, I replied. Well, goodbye. You can go now, I added when he didn't move. I'm busy. There was something else, he said. I'd already turned my back on him. What? I don't know how to fence. He was born, he told me, in a hay barn on the moor overlooking his father's house, at noon on Midsummer's Day. His mother, who should have known better, had insisted on riding out in the dog cart with her maid to take lunch to the hawking party. Her pains came on and there wasn't time to get back to the house.
but the barn was there and full of clean hay, with a stream nearby. His father, riding home with his hawk on his wrist, saw her from the track, lying in the hay with the baby on her lap. He'd had a good day, he told her. They'd got 4 pigeons and a heron. His father hadn't wanted to go to Ultramar, but he held of the Duke, and the Duke was going, so he didn't really have any choice. In the event, the Duke died of camp fever a week after they landed. The boy's father lasted 9 months. Then he got himself killed by his best friend in a pointless brawl in a tavern. He was 22 when he died.
The same age, said the boy, as I am now.
That's a sad story, I told him, and a very stupid one. Mind you, all stories from Ultramar are stupid, if you ask me. He scowled at me.
Maybe there's too much stupidity in the world, he said. Maybe I want to do something about it.
I nodded. You could diminish the quantity considerably by dying, I grant you. But maybe it's too high a price to pay. His eyes were cold and bright. The man who killed my father is still alive, he said. He's settled and prosperous. Happy. He's got everything he could possibly want. He came through the nightmare of Ultramar, and now the world makes sense to him again, and he's a useful and productive member of society, admired and respected by his peers and his betters. So you're going to cut his throat? He shook his head.
Not likely, he said. That would be murder.
No.
I'm going to fight him sword to sword. I'm going to beat him and prove myself the better man. Then I'll kill him.
I was tactfully silent for a moment. Then I said, and you know absolutely nothing about sword fighting.
No.
My father should have taught me. It's what fathers do. But he died when I was 2 years old. I don't know the first thing about it. And you're going to challenge an old soldier. And you're going to prove yourself the better man. I see. He was looking me straight in the eye. I always feel uncomfortable when people do that, even though I spend my life gazing at white-hot metal.
I asked about you, he said. They reckon you were a great fencer.
I sighed. Who told you that?
Were you?
Were implies a state of affairs that no longer prevails, I said. Who told you about me? He shrugged.
Friends of my father. You were a legend in Ultramar, apparently.
Everybody'd heard of you. The defining characteristic of a legend is that it isn't true, I said. I can fight, a bit. What's that got to do with anything?
You're going to teach me.
I remember one time in Ultramar. We were smashing up this village. We did a lot of that. They called it chevauché, but that's just chivalry talk for burning barns and stamping on chickens. It's supposed to break the enemy's will to fight. Curiously enough, it has exactly the opposite effect. Anyway, I was in this farmyard. I had a torch in my hand, and I was going to set fire to a hayrick, like you do. And there was this dog. It was a stupid little thing, the sort you keep to catch rats, little more than a rat itself. And it jumped out at me, barking its head off, and it sank its teeth into my leg, and it simply would not let go. And I couldn't get at it to stab it with my knife, not without stabbing myself in the process. I dropped the torch and danced round the farmyard, trying to squash it against walls. But it didn't seem to make any odds. It was the most ridiculous little thing. And in the end, it beat me. I staggered out into the lane and it let go, dropped off, and sprinted back into the yard. My sergeant had to light the rick with a fire arrow, and I never lived it down. I looked at him. I recognized the look in his silly pink face. Is that right? I said.
Yes. I need the best sword and the best teacher. I'll pay you. You can have the 5th coin.
A gold bezant. Actually, the proper name is Hyperpyron, meaning extra fine. The enemy took so many of them off us in Ultramar that they adopted them in place of their own currency. That's war for you. The enemy turn into you, and you turn into them, like the iron and steel rods under the hammer. The only bezants you see over here are ones that got brought back, but they're current everywhere. I'm not interested in money, I said.
I know. Neither am I.
But if you pay a man to do a job and he takes your money, he's obliged.
I'm a lousy teacher, I told him.
That's all right.
I'm a hopeless student. We'll get on like a barn on fire.
If ever I get a dog, it'll be one of those rat-like terriers. Maybe I just warm to aggressive creatures. I don't know.
You can take your coin and stick it where the sun doesn't shine. I told him,
you overpaid me for the sword. We'll call it change. The sword isn't a very good weapon. Most forms of armor are proof against it, including a properly padded jerkin. It's too long to be handy in a scrum and too light and flimsy for serious bashing. In a pitched battle, give me a spear or an axe any time. In fact, 9 times out of 10 you'd be better off with everyday farm tools. Staff hooks, bean hooks, muck forks, provided they're made of good material and properly tempered. Better still, give me a bow and someone in armor to hide behind. The fighting man's best view of a battlefield is down an arrow from under a pikeman's armpit. For self-defense on the road, I favor the quarterstaff. In the streets or indoors, where space to move is at a premium, the knife you cut your bread and peel your apples with is as good as anything. You're used to it, for one thing, and you know where it is on your belts without having to look. About the only thing a sword is really good for is sword fighting, which in practice means dueling, which is idiotic and against the law, or fencing, which is playing at fighting. Good fun and nobody gets hurt, but not really my idea of entertainment. And showing off. Which is why, needless to say, we all went to Ultramar with swords on our hips. Some of us had beautiful new swords. The more fortunate ones had really old swords. Family heirlooms, worth 1,000 acres of good farmland, with building stock and tenants. The thing is, don't say I told you so. The old ones aren't necessarily the best. There was even less good steel about 200 years ago than there is now. And men were stronger then, so old swords are heavier, harder to use, broader, and with rounded points for cutting, not thrusting. Not that it mattered. Most of those young swashbucklers died of the poisoned shits before the desert sun had had a chance to fade the clothes they arrived in, and their swords were sold to pay their mess bills. You could pick up some real bargains back then in Ultramar. I don't know how to teach, I said. I've never ever done it. So I'm going to teach you the way my father taught me, because it's the only way I know. Is that all right? He didn't notice me picking up the rake.
Fine,
he said. So I pulled the head off the rake, it was always loose, and hit him with the handle. I remember my first lesson so well. The main difference was my father used a broom. First, he poked me in the stomach, hard, with one end. As I doubled up, gasping for breath, he hit my kneecap, so I fell over. Then he put the end of the broom handle on my throat and applied controlled pressure. I could only just breathe.
You didn't get out of the way, he explained.
I was 5 when I had my first lesson, and easier to teach to the ground than a full-grown man. I had to tread on the inside of his knee to get him to drop. When eventually he got his breath back, I saw he was crying, actually in tears.
You didn't get out of the way, I explained.
He looked up at me and wiped his nose with the back of his hand.
I see, he said.
You won't make that mistake again, I told him. From now on, whenever a fellow human being is close enough to hit you, you're going to assume that he's going to hit you. You'll keep your distance, or you'll be ready to avoid at a split second's notice. Got that?
I think so.
No exceptions, I said. Not any, ever. Your brother, your best friend, your wife, your 6-year-old daughter, it makes no odds. Otherwise, you'll never be a fighter. He stared at me for a moment, and I guessed he'd understood. It was like that moment in the old play, where the devil offers the scholar the contract, and the scholar signs it. Get up. I hit him again when he was halfway to his feet. It was just a light tap on the collarbone, just enough to hurt like hell without breaking anything.
This is all for my own good, I take it.
Oh, yes. This is the most important lesson you'll ever learn.
We spent the next 4 hours on footwork,
the traces, which is backwards and forwards, and the traverses, which is side to side. Each time I hit him, I laid it on a bit harder. He got there eventually. My father wasn't a bad man. He loved his family dearly, with all his heart. Nothing meant more to him. But he had a slight, let's say, kink in his nature, like the cold spot or the inclusion you sometimes get in a weld where the metal wasn't quite hot enough, or a bit of grit or crap gets beaten into the joint. He liked hurting people. It gave him a thrill. Only people, not animals. He was a fine stock man and a humane and conscientious hunter, but he dearly loved to hit people and make them squeal. I can understand that, partly because I'm the same, though to a lesser degree, and I control it better. Maybe it's always been there in the blood, or maybe it was a souvenir from Ultramar. Both, probably. I rationalize it in forge welding terms. You can heat the metal white hot, but you can't just lay one bit on top of the other and expect them to weld. You've got to hit them to make the join. Carefully, judiciously, not too hard and not too soft. Just enough to make the metal cry and weep sparks. I hate it when they burst into tears, though. It makes me despise them, and I have to take pains to control my temper. Anyway, you can see why I like to stay out of people's way. I know what's wrong with me, and knowing your own flaws is the beginning of wisdom. I'm sort of a reverse fencer. I stay well out of distance, partly so that people can't hit me. Mostly so I can't hit them. Once you've learned footwork, the rest is relatively easy. I taught him the 8 cuts and the 7 wards. I stick to 7. The other 4 are just elaborations. He picked them up quickly, now that he understood the essence. Don't let him hurt you. Followed by, make him safe. The best way to make a man safe, I told him, is to hurt him. Pain will stop him in his tracks. Killing doesn't always do it. You can stab a man and he'll be past all hope, but he can still hurt you very badly before he drops to the ground. But if you paralyze him with pain, he's no longer a threat. You can then dispatch him, or let him go, at your pleasure. I demonstrated. I flicked past his guard and prodded him in the stomach with my rake handle. A lethal thrust, but he was still on his feet. Then I cracked him on the knee, and he dropped. Killing's irrelevant. I told him, pain wins fights. That's unless you've absolutely set your heart on cleaving him to the navel. And that's just melodrama, which will get you killed. In a battle, hurt him and move on to the next threat. In a duel, win and be merciful. Fewer legal problems that way. I was rather enjoying being a teacher, as you've probably gathered. I was passing on valuable knowledge and skill, which is in itself rewarding. I was showing off, and I was hitting an annoying sprig of the nobility for his own good. What's not to like? You learn best when you're exhausted, desperate, and in pain. Ultramar taught me that. I kept him at it from dawn till dusk, and then we lit the lamp and did theory. I taught him the line and the circle. Instinctively, you want to fight up and down a line. Forwards to attack, backwards to defend. Parry, then lunge, then parry. All wrong. Idiotic. Instead, you should fight in a circle, stepping sideways, so you avoid him and can hit him at the same time. Never just defend. Always counterattack. Every hand stroke you make should be a killing stroke or a stopping stroke. And for every movement of the hand, a movement of the foot. There. I've just taught you the whole secret and mystery of swordsmanship, and I never had to hit you once. Most fights, I told him, giving him a chance to wipe the blood out of his eyes before we moved on, in which at least one party is competent, last 1 to 4 seconds. Anything more than that is a fitting subject for epic poetry. Judging that he wasn't ready yet, I shot a quick manderito at the side of his head. He stepped back and left out of the way without thinking, and my heart rejoiced inside me as I sidestepped his riposte in straight time and closed the door with the 3rd ward. So far, he hadn't hit me once, which was a little disappointing. but he'd come close 4 times in 6 hours. Very promising indeed. He just lacked the killer instinct. The fifth ward, I went on, and he lunged. I almost didn't read it, because he disguised the boar's tooth as the iron gate. All I could do was trace back very fast and smack the stick out of his hands. Then I whacked him for interrupting me when I was talking. He very nearly got out of the way, but I wanted to hit him, so he couldn't. He had to pick himself up off the ground after that. I took a long step back to signal a truce. I think it's time for a progress report, I said. At the moment, you're very good indeed. Not the best in the world, but more than capable of beating 99 men in 100. Would you like to stop there and save yourself further pain and humiliation? He got up slowly and dabbed at his cut eye. I want to be the best, he said. If that's all right? I shrugged. I don't think you ever can be, I told him. In order to be the best, you have to lose so much. It's just not worth it. Being the best will make you into a monster. Stick with just plain good. You'll be so much happier. He was a pitiful sight, all cuts and bruises. But still, under all the blood and discolored tissue, a hopeful, pretty boy. I think I'd like to carry on just a bit longer, if you don't mind. Please yourself, I said, and let him pick up his stick. Actually, he reminded me a lot of myself at his age. I was a brash, irritating boy when I went to Ultramar. I'd known all along that I wasn't going to get the land, having elder brothers in good health. Probably I'd always resented that. I think I'd have made a good farmer. I was always the one who wasn't afraid of hard work, who saw the need to get things done, not tomorrow or when we've got 5 minutes or when it stops raining, but now, right now, before the roof tree breaks and the barn falls down, before the fence posts snap off and the sheep get out into the marsh, before the oats spoil on the stalk, before the meat goes off in the heat. Now, while there's still time, before it's too late. Instead, I saw the place gradually falling to pieces, and decline and decay are so peacefully gradual. Grass takes so long to grow up through the cobbles, it's imperceptible, therefore not threatening. But my father and my brothers didn't share my view. I was keen to get away from them. I wanted to take a sword and slice myself a fat chunk of the world off the bone. There's good land in Ultramar, they told me. All it needs is a bit of hard work, and it could be the best in the world. The very best. That's a concept that's danced ahead of me, just out of reach, all my life. Now, of course, I am the very best, at one small corner of one specific craft. I'm stuck, wedged in by my own preeminence, like a rafter lying across your leg in a burning house. But never mind, I went to Ultramar aiming to be a farmer. When I got there, I found what was left after 70 years of continual reciprocal chevauchées. I recognized it at once. It was what was going to happen to my father's land back home, but in macrocosm. All the barns fallen, all the fences broken down, all the crops spoilt, briars and nettles neck high in all the good pastures, the effects of peace and idleness accelerated and forced, like you force early crops under straw, by the merely instrumental action of the wars. Cut myself off a slice of that, I said to myself. Why the hell would I want to bother? So I started hurting people instead. And the thing is, if you do it in war, they praise you for it. Strange, but true. In war, there's so much scope. You can afford to be selective. You can afford to limit yourself to hurting the enemy, of whom there are plenty to go round, and twice as many again once you've finished what's on your plate. I survived in Ultramar because I was having the time of my life, for a while. Odd thing about farmers. They love their land and their stock and their buildings, fences, trees, but give them the chance to wreck someone else's land, kill their stock, burn their buildings, smash their fences, maim their trees, and after a brief show of reluctance, they go to it with a will. I think it's just basic revenge. Take that, agriculture, that'll learn you.
Volunteers for a chevauchee? My hand was up before I had time to think. And then I did something bad, and I had to come home. I cried when they pronounced sentence. I despise men who cry. They told me I was to be spared the noose in recognition of my years of valiant and honorable service. I don't think so. I think they were just being very, very spiteful. There came a moment, very sudden and unexpected, when it was over and I'd succeeded. I went to smack him, a faint high, followed by a cut low, and he simply wasn't there to be hit. And then my ear stung horribly, and while I was confused and distracted by the pain, he dug me in the pit of the stomach with his broom handle. He wasn't like me. He took a long step back and let me recover.
I'm sorry, he said.
It took me quite a while to get back enough breath to say,
No, don't apologize, whatever you do.
Then I squared up into first. Again.
Really?
Don't be so bloody stupid. Again. I let him come at me, because attacking is so much harder. I read him like a book, swung easily into a traverse and the devastating vault, my speciality, and he cracked me on the elbow as I floundered past him, then prodded me in the small of the back just before I overbalanced and fell over. He helped me up.
I think I'm starting to get the hang of this, he said.
I went for him. I wanted to beat him more than I've ever wanted anything. I couldn't get anywhere near him, and he kept hitting me, gently, just to make a point. After a dozen or so passes, I dropped to my knees. All my strength had drained out of me, as though one of his gentle prods had punctured right to my heart.
I give up,
I said.
You win.
He was looking down at me with a sort of confused frown.
I don't follow.
You've beaten me, I said. You're now the better man.
Really?
What do you want? A bloody certificate? Yes.
He nodded slowly.
Which makes you the best ever teacher, he said. Thank you.
I threw away the rake handle.
You're welcome, I said. Now go away. We're finished with each other.
He was still looking at me.
So, am I really the best swordsman in the world?
I laughed.
I don't know about that, I said. But you're better than me. That makes you very good indeed. I hope you're satisfied, because as far as I'm concerned, this has been a pretty pointless exercise.
No,
he said, and his tone of voice made me look at him.
This was all for a purpose. Remember?
Actually, I'd forgotten, briefly.
Oh, yes,
I said. It's so you can kill the man who murdered your father. I shook my head.
You still want to do that?
Oh, yes.
I sighed. I'd hoped I might have smacked some sense into you, I said.
Come on. You must have learned something. Think about it. What's that possibly going to achieve?
It'll make me feel better, he said.
Right.
I don't think so. I've killed God knows how many people. All of them the enemy. And believe me, it never makes you feel better. It just hardens you, like forging the edges.
He grinned. And hard is brittle.
Yes, I know. The extended metaphor hasn't been lost on me, I assure you. It didn't hurt quite so much by then, and I was breathing almost normally.
Well,
I said, I guess it's something you've got to get out of your system. Then you can get on with your life.
You carry on, and good luck to you.
He smiled at me awkwardly.
So I have your blessing, then?
That's a bloody stupid way of putting it. But if you want to, then yes. My blessing goes with you, my son. There. Is that what you wanted?
He laughed. As a father you have been to me. For a little while. It was a quotation from somewhere, though I can't place it.
You think I can beat him?
I don't see why not.
Neither do I, he said. It's always easier the second time.
Now I'm not particularly slow on the uptake, Not usually. But I admit, it took me a moment. And in that moment he said, "You never asked my name." "Well?" "My name is Emmerich de Peguilhan," he said. "My father was Bernhard de Peguilhan. You murdered him in a brawl, in Altramar. You smashed his skull with a stone bottle when his back was turned." He dropped the broom handle. "Wait now," he said. "I'll fetch the swords and be right back." I'm telling this story so you know what happened. He had the best sword ever made, and I taught him everything I ever knew. And he ended up better than me. He was always better than me, just like his father. Nearly everybody's better than me in most respects. One way in which he excelled me was he lacked the killer instinct. But he made a pretty fight of it. I give him that. I wish you could have watched that fight instead of being in it. There never was better entertainment, and all wasted, because there was nobody to see. Naturally, you lose all track of time. But my best educated guess is we fought for at least 5 minutes, which is an eternity, and never a hair's breadth of difference between us. It was like fighting your own shadow, or your reflection in the mirror. I read his mind, he read mine. To continue the tedious extended metaphor, it was forge welding at its finest. Well, I look back on it in these terms, the same way I look back on all my best completed work, with pleasure, once it's over, but hating every minute of it while I'm actually doing it. When I wake up in the middle of the night in a muck sweat, I tell myself I won because he trod on a stone and turned his ankle, and the tiny atom of advantage was enough. But it's not true. I'm ashamed to say I beat him fair and square, through stamina and the simple desire to win. Killer instinct. I made a little window of opportunity by feigning an error. He believed me and was deceived. It was only a tiny opportunity, no scope for choice. I had a fraction of a second when his throat was exposed, and I could reach it with a scratch cut with a point, what we call a stramazzone. I cut his throat, then jumped back to keep from getting splashed all over. Then I buried him in the midden, along with the pig bones and the household shit. He should have won. Of course he should. He was basically a good kid, and had he lived, he'd probably have been all right, more or less. No worse than my father, at any rate, and definitely a damn sight better than me. I like to tell myself he died so quickly, he never knew he'd lost. But, on the day, I proved myself the better man, which is what sword fighting is all about. It's a simple, infallible test, and he failed and I passed. The best man always wins, because the definition of best is still alive at the end. Feel at liberty to disagree, but you'll be wrong. I hate it, but it's the only definition that makes any sense at all. Every morning I cough up black soot and grey mud, the gift of the fire and the grindstone. Smiths don't live long. The harder you work, the better you get, the more poisonous muck you breathe in. My preeminence will be the death of me someday. I sold his sword to the Duke of Scona for, I forget how much. It was a stupid amount of money, at any rate. But the Duke said he wanted the very best, and he got what he paid for. My barrel of gold is now nearly full, incidentally. I don't know what I'll do when the level reaches the top. Something idiotic, probably. I may have all the other faults in the world, but at least I'm honest. You have to grant me that.
Robin Hobb. New York Times bestseller Robin Hobb is one of the most popular writers in fantasy today, having sold more than 1 million copies of her work in paperback. She's perhaps best known for her epic fantasy Farseer series, including Assassin's Apprentice, Royal Assassin, Assassin's Quest, as well as the two fantasy series related to it, the Live Ship Traders series consisting of Ship of Magic, The Mad Ship, and Ship of Destiny, and the Tawny Man series made up of Fool's Errand, The Golden Fool, and Fool's Fate. She's also the author of the Soldier Son series, composed of Shaman's Crossing, Forest Mage, and Renegade's Magic, and the Rain Wild Chronicles, consisting of Dragon Keeper, Dragon Haven, City of Dragons, and Blood of Dragons. Most recently, she started a new series, the Fitz and the Fool Trilogy, consisting of Fool's Assassin, Fool's Quest, and coming up in 2017, Assassin's Fate. Hobb also writes under her real name, Megan Lindholm. Books by Megan Lindholm include the fantasy novels Wizard of the Pigeons, Harpy's Flight, The Wind Singers, The Limbreath Gate, Luck of the Wolves, The Reindeer People, Wolf's Brother, and Cloven Hooves. The science fiction novel Alien Earth, and with Stephen Brust, the collaborative novel The Gypsy. Lindholm's most recent book is a collaborative collection with Robin Hobb, The Inheritance and Other Stories. In the chilling tale that follows, Fitz Chivalry Farseer visits a village caught up in the Red Ship Wars, where the unhappy villagers face some very hard choices, none of them good, and some of them worse than others.
Her Father's Sword, Robin Hobb. Tora shifted on her lookout's platform. Cold was stiffening her, and calling two skinny logs tied across a couple of outreaching branches, a watchtower platform, was generous. A flat surface would have been kinder to her buttocks and back. She shifted to a squat and checked the position of the moon again. When it was over the hummock on Last Chance Point, her watch would be over and Kerry would come to relieve her. In theory. They'd given her the least likely point of entry to the village. Her tree overlooked the market trail that led inland to High Ground Market where they sold their fish. Unlikely that Forged would come from this direction. The kidnapped people had been forced from their homes and down to the beach, past their burned fishing boats and the ransacked smoking racks for preserving the catch. The captured townsfolk had gone. A boy who had dared to follow his kidnapped mother said the raiders had forced their folk into boats and rowed them out to a red-hulled ship anchored offshore. As they had been taken to the sea, so they would return from the waves. Tora had seen them go from her hiding place in the big willow that overlooked the harbor. The raiders hadn't seemed to care who they took. She'd seen Old Pa Grimby and Salal Greenoak carrying her nursing baby. She'd seen the little Bodby twins and Kelia and Rudan and Cope. And her father, roaring and staggering with blood sheeting down the side of his face. She had known the names of almost every captive. Smokerscott was not a big village. There were perhaps 600 folk here. Well, there had been perhaps 600 before the raid. After the raid, Tora had helped stack the bodies after they'd put out the fires. She'd stopped counting after 40, and those were just the people in the stack on the east end of the village. There'd been another pyre near the rickety dock. No, the dock wasn't rickety anymore. It was charred pilings sticking out of the water, next to the sunken hulks of the small fishing fleet. Her father's boat was among them. The changes had all happened so fast that it was hard to remember them. Earlier tonight, she'd decided to run back home and get a warmer cloak. Then she'd recalled that her home was wet ash and charred planks. It wasn't the only one. The five adjoining houses had burned, and dozens of others in the village. Even the Kelp's grand house, two stories, not even finished, was now a smoking pile of timbers. She shifted on her platform, and something poked her. She'd sat on her whistle on its lanyard. The village council had given her a cudgel and a whistle to blow if she saw anyone approaching. Two blasts from her whistle would bring the strong folk from the village with their weapons. They would come with their poles and axes and gaff hooks. and Jelen would come, wearing her father's sword. What if no one came to her whistle? She had a cudgel, as if she were going to climb down from the tree and try to bash someone, as if she could bear to club people she had known since she was a babe. A rhythmic clopping reached her ears. A horse approaching? It was past sundown, and few travelers came to Smoker's Cot at any time, save the fish buyers who came at the end of summer to dicker for the fall run of redfish. But in winter? And after dark? Who would be coming this way? She watched the narrow stripe of hard-packed earth that led through the forested hills to high ground, peering through the darkness. A horse and rider came into sight, a single rider and horse, bearing a lumpy bundle on the saddle before him and two bulging panniers behind him. As she stared, the bundle wriggled and gave a long whine, then burst into the full-throated fury of an angry child. She blew a single blast on her whistle, the maybe it's danger signal. The rider halted and stared toward her perch. He did not reach for a bow. Indeed, it looked to be all he could do to restrain the child that he held before him. She stood, rolled her back a bit to remove some of the chill-stiffened kinks, and began to climb down. By the time she reached the ground, Marva and Carver had appeared. And Kerry, long past his time to come and relieve her. They stood with tall poles, blocking the horse's path. Over the sound of the child's wailing, they were trying to question him. By their torches, she saw a young man with dark hair and eyes. His thick wool cloak was buck blue. She wondered what was in his horse's panniers. He finally shouted,
"Will someone take this boy from me? He says his name is Peavy, and his mother's name is Keelia. He said he lived in Smoker's Cot, and pointed this way. Does he belong here?"
"Keelia's boy," Marva exclaimed, and came closer to examine the kicking, wriggling child. "Peavy! Peavy, it's me, Cousin Marva! Come to me now! Come to me!"
As the man started to lower the child from his tall black mount, the small boy twisted to hit at him, shouting,
"I hate you! I hate you! Let me go!"
Marva stepped back suddenly.
"He's forged, isn't he? Oh, sweet Ida, what shall we do? He's just four and Keely's only child. The raiders must have taken him when they took her. I thought he died in the fires."
"He's not forged," the rider said with some impatience. "He's angry because I had no food for him. Please, take him."
The youngster was kicking his heels against the horse's shoulder and varying his now incoherent wails with shouting for his mother. Marva stepped forward. Peavy kicked her a few times before she engulfed him in her arms.
"Peavy, Peavy, it's me, you're safe. Oh, lovey, you're safe now. You're so cold. Can you calm down?"
"I'm hungry," the boy shouted. "I'm cold. Mosquitoes bit me and I cut my hands on the barnacles. And Mama threw me off the boat. She threw me off the boat into the dark water and she didn't care. I screamed and the boat left me in the water and the waves pushed me and I had to climb up the rocks. Then I was losted in the wood."
He aired all his grievances in a child's shrill voice. Tora edged up beside Kerry. "Your watch now," she reminded him.
"I know that," he told her in disdain as he stared down at her.
She shrugged. She'd reminded him. It wasn't her task to see he did his share. She'd done hers. The stranger dismounted. He led his horse into the village, as if certain of that right. Tora marked how everyone fell in around him, forgetting to challenge him at all. Well, he wasn't forged. A forged one would never have helped a child. He gave the boy in Marva's arms a sympathetic look.
"That explains a great deal."
He looked over at Carver.
"The boy darted out of the forest, right in front of my horse, crying and shouting for help. I'm glad he has kin still alive to take him in. And sorry that you were raided. You aren't the only ones. Up the coast, Shrike was raided last week. That's where I was bound." "And who are you?"
Carver demanded suspiciously.
King Shrewd received a bird from Shrike and dispatched me right away. My name is Fitzchivalry Farseer. I was sent to help at Shrike. I didn't know you'd been raided as well. I cannot stay long, but I can tell you what you need to know to deal with this.
He lifted his voice to address those who had trooped out to see what Tora's whistle meant.
I can teach you how to deal with the Forged Ones, as much as we know how to deal with them.
He looked around at the circle of staring faces and said more strongly,
The king has sent me to help folk like you. Man your watch stations, but call a meeting of everyone else in the village. I need to speak to all of you. Your Forged Ones may return at any time. One man?
Kaba asked angrily.
We sent word to our king that we are raided, that folk are carried off by the Red Ship raiders, and he sends us one man. Chivalry's bastard, someone said.
It sounded like Headley, but Tora couldn't be certain in the dusk. Folk were coming out of the houses that remained standing and joining the trailing group of people following the messenger and his horse. The man ignored the slur.
The king did not send me here, but to Shrike. I've come out of my way to bring the boy back to you. Did the raiders leave your inn standing? I'd appreciate a meal and a place to stable my horse. Last night we were out in the rain, and the inn might be a good place for folk to gather to hear what I have to say. Smoker's Scott never had an inn. Not much call for one. The road ends here at the cove. Everyone who lives here sleeps in his own bed at night.
Carver sounded insulted that the king's man could have imagined Smoker Scott had an inn. They used to, Tora said quietly. Now a lot of us don't have beds to sleep in. Where was she going to sleep tonight? Probably at her neighbor's house. Jelen had offered her a blanket on the floor by his fire. That was a kind thing to do, her mother had said. The neighborly thing to do. Her younger brother Jeff had echoed her words exactly. And when Jelen had asked for it, they'd given him Papa's sword, as if they owed it to him for doing a decent thing. The sword was one of the few things they had saved from their house when the raiders set it on fire. Your brother is too young, and you will never be strong enough to swing it. Let Jelen have it. So her mother had said, and sternly shushed her when she'd discovered what they had done. Remember what your father always said. Do what you must to survive, and don't look back. Tora recalled well when he'd said that. He and his crew of two had dumped most of their catch overboard so they could ride out a sudden storm. Tora thought it was quite one thing to surrender something valuable to stay alive, and quite another to give away the last valuable thing they had to a swaggering braggart. Her mother might say she'd never been strong enough to swing it, but she didn't know that Tora could already lift it. Several times when her father had taken it out of an evening to wipe it clean and oil it fresh, he'd let her hold it. It always took both her hands, but the last time she'd been able to lift it and swing it, however awkwardly. Papa had given a gruff laugh. The heart but not the muscle. Too bad. I could have used a tall son with your spirit. He'd given Jeff a sideways glance. Or any sort of son with a mind, he'd mutter. But she had not been a son, and instead of her father's size and strength, she was small, like her mother. She was of an age to work the boat alongside her father, but he'd never taken her. Not enough room on the deck for a hand who can't pull the full weight of a deckhand's duties. It's too bad. And that was the end of it. But still, later that month, he'd again let her lift the bared sword. She'd swung it twice before the weight of it had drawn the point of it down to the earth again. And her father had smiled at her. But now, Papa was gone, taken by the Red Ship raiders, and she had nothing of his. Tora was the elder. The sword should have been hers, whether she could swing it or not. But the way it had happened, she'd had no real say. She'd come back from dragging bodies to the pyre, come back to Jelen's house to see the sword standing in its sheath in the corner, like a broom. She and her mother and Jeff could sleep on the floor of Jelen's house, and he could have the last valuable item her family owned. And her mother thought that was good. How was that a fair trade? It cost him nothing for them to sleep on his floor. Clearly her mother had no idea of how to survive. Don't think about that.
The fish smoking shed,
Kaba was saying.
It's mostly empty now, but we can start up the fires for heat instead of smoke, and gather a lot of folk there.
That would be good, the stranger said.
Marva smiled up at him. Peavy had stopped struggling. He had his arms around his cousin's neck, and his face buried in her cloak.
There is room in our home for you to sleep, sir, and too much room now in our goat shed for your horse.
Her smile twisted bitterly.
The raid has left us few animals to shelter.
What they did not take, they killed.
I'm sorry to hear that,
he said wearily. And it seemed to Tora it was a tale he had heard before, and perhaps that was what he always replied to it. Kaba sent runners through the village, calling the folk to gather in the fish-smoking shed. Tora felt childish satisfaction when he ordered Kerry to take up his watch. She followed the crowd to the shed. Several families were already sheltering there. They had a fire going, and had set up makeshift households in different parts of the shed. Had her mother thought of coming here? At least they would still be a separate family, a household. They would still have had Papa's sword. Kaba tipped over a crate for the messenger to stand upon, as the villagers gathered in the barn-like shed that always smelt of alder smoke and fish. The folk trickled in slowly, and Tora could see the stranger's impatience growing. Finally, he climbed onto his small stage and called for silence.
We dare not wait any longer. The forged will be returned to your village at any time now. That we know. It is a pattern the Red Ship raiders have followed since they first attacked Forge and returned half its inhabitants as heartless ghosts of themselves.
He looked down and saw the confusion on the faces that surrounded him. He spoke more simply.
The Red Ships come. The raiders kill and they plunder. But their real destruction comes after they have left. They carry off those you love. They do something to them, something we don't understand. They hold them for a time, then give them back to you, their families. They will return tired, hungry, wet, and cold. They will look like your kin, and they will call you by name. But they will not be the folk who left here.
He looked out over the gathered folk and shook his head at the hope and disbelief that his words had stirred. Tora watched him try to explain.
They will recall your faces and names. A father will know his children's names, and a baker will recall her pans and oven. They will seek out their own homes, but you must not let them into your village or homes, because they will care nothing for you, only for themselves. Thefts and beatings, murders and rape will come with them.
Tara stared up at him. His words made no sense. Other faces reflected the same confusion, for the man shook his head sorrowfully.
It's difficult to explain. A father will snatch food from his little boy's mouth. If you have something they want, they will take it, regardless of how much violence they must use. If they are hungry, they will take all the food for themselves, drive you from your homes if they wish shelter.
His voice dropped as he added,
if they feel lost, they will rape.
His gaze roved over them. Then he added,
they will rape anyone.
He shook his head at the disbelief on their faces.
Listen to me, please. Everything you have heard about the Forged, every rumor you have heard, is true. Go home and fortify your homes now. Tighten the shutters on your windows. Be sure the bars on your doors are strong. Organize the people who will protect this village. Assemble them. Arm yourselves. You've set a watch. That's good.
He drew breath, and Tora called into the pause. But what are we to do when they come? He looked directly at her. Possibly he was a handsome man, when he was not cold and weary. The tops of his cheeks were red, and his dark hair lank with rain or sweat. His brown eyes were agonized.
The people who went away are not coming back to you. The Forged will not change back into those people. Ever.
His next words came out harshly.
You must be prepared to kill them, before they kill you.
Abruptly, Tora hated him. Handsome or not, he was talking about her father. Her father, big strong Burke, coming back from a day's fishing, unarmed and unprepared to be clubbed down and dragged away. When her mother had screamed at her to run and hide, she had. She'd been so sure that her father, her big strong papa, would fight his way clear of his captors. So she had done nothing to help him. She'd hidden in the thicket of the willow's branches while he was dragged away. The next morning she and her mother found each other when they returned to the remains of their house. Jeff had stood outside their burned home, wailing as if he were 5 instead of 13. They'd let him stand and weep. Both Tora and her mother knew there was no getting through to her simple brother. In a light drizzle of freezing rain, they'd poked through the scorched timbers and the thick ash of the fallen thatch that had been their home. There had been little to salvage. Jeff had stood and bawled as Tora and her mother had poked through the smouldering wreckage. A few cooking pots and 3 woolen blankets had been in a heavy cupboard that had somehow not burned through. A bowl and 3 plates. Then she'd found, sheltered beneath the fallen timber and unscorched, her father's sword in its fine sheath. The sword that would have saved him if he'd had it with him. Worthless Jelen now claimed it as his. The sword that should have been hers. She knew how her father would have reacted to her mother's bartering the sword for shelter. She pinched her lips tight as she thought of Papa. Burke was not the kindest, gentlest father one could imagine. He was, in fact, very much as the king's man had described a forged man. He ate first and best at their meals, and had always expected to be deferred to in all things. He was quick with a slap, and slow to praise. In his early life, he'd been a warrior. If he needed something, he found a way to get it. She knew a tiny flame of hope. Perhaps, even forged, he would still be her father. He might come home, well, back to the village where their home had stood. He might still rise before dawn to take their small boat out to... Oh, the boat that now rested on the bottom, with only a handspan of its mast sticking up. But she knew her father. He'd know how to raise it. He'd know how to build their house again. Perhaps there might be some return to her old life. Just her family, sitting beside their own fire in the evening. Their food on the table, their beds. And he'd take back his sword, too. The king's man wasn't having a great deal of luck persuading the village that their returning kin should be barred from the village, let alone murdered. She doubted he knew what he was about. Surely if a mother remembered her child's name and face, she would remember that she cared about that child. How could it be otherwise? He soon saw he was not swaying them to his thinking. His voice dropped.
I will see to my horse and spend one night here. If you want help to fortify some of your homes, or this shed, I'll help with that. But if you will not ready yourselves, there is little I can do here. And yours is not the only village to be forged. The king sent me to Shrike. Chance brought me here.
Old Hallen spoke up.
We know how to take care of our own. If Keelan comes back, he'll still be my son. Why wouldn't I feed him and give him shelter?
Do you think I will kill my father because he behaves selfishly? You're madman. If you are the sort of help King Shrewd sends us, we're better off without it. Blood is thicker than water, someone shouted, and suddenly everyone seemed angry at the king's messenger. His face sank into deeper lines of weariness.
As you will, he said, in a lifeless voice.
As we will indeed, Carba shouted. Did you think no one would look in the panniers on your mount? They're full of loaves of bread. Yet seeing how devastated we are, you said nothing and made no offer to share. Who is heartless and selfish now, Fitzchivalry Farseer?
Carba lifted his hands high and cried out to the crowd.
We ask King Shrew to send us help, and he sends one man, and a bastard at that. He hoards bread that would ease our children's bellies and tells us to slay our kin. This is not the help we sought.
I hope you touch none of it, the man replied. His eyes, so earnest before, had gone distant and dark.
The bread is poisoned. It's to use against the forged in Shrike. To kill them, and put an end to the murders and rapes there.
Carba looked stunned. Then he shouted,
Get out! Leave our village now, tonight! We've had enough of you and your help! Be gone!
The Farseer didn't quail. He looked out over the gathered folk. Then he stepped down off the crate.
As you will.
He did not shout the word, but his words carried.
If you will not help yourselves, there is nothing I can do here. I'll be on my way. When I have finished my tasks at Shrike, I will come back this way. Perhaps by then, you will be ready to listen.
Not very likely,
Carba sneered at him. The king's envoy walked slowly to the door. His hand was not on his sword hilt, but the crowd flowed back to make way for him. Tora was one of those who followed him. His horse was still tethered outside. The lid of one pannier was loosened. The man paused to secure it. He patted the horse's neck, untethered her, mounted, and rode off into the darkness without a backward glance. He left the way he had come, and the sound of his mount's hooves faded slowly. In the morning, the rain continued, and the day dragged by. None of the kidnapped folk returned. The red-hulled ship was no longer anchored at the edge of the bay. Jelen began to assert his authority over her family. Her mother helped with the cooking, and Jeff salvaged wood that could be used to rebuild, or as firewood. When Tora came in from standing her watches, Jelen commanded her to tend his brat, so his wife Darda could rest. Cordell was a spoiled, snotty two-year-old who toddled about knocking things over and shrieking when he was reprimanded. His clothing was constantly soiled, and they expected Tora to rinse out his dirtied napkins and hang them on the line above the fireplace to dry. As if anything could dry on the chill, damp days that followed the raid. When Tora complained, her mother would hastily remind her that some folk were sheltering under salvaged sails or sleeping on the dirt floors of the fish-smoking shed. She spoke low at such times, as if fearful that Jelen would overhear her complaints and turn them out. She told Tara that she should be grateful to help the household that had taken her in. Tora did not feel grateful at all. It grated on her to see her mother cooking and cleaning like a servant in a house that was not theirs. Even worse was to see how Jeff followed Jelen about, as anxious to please as a hound puppy. It was not as if Jelen treated him well. He ordered the boy about, teased and mocked him, and Jeff laughed nervously at the taunts. Jelen worked the boy as if he were a donkey, and they both came home from trying to raise Jelen's fishing boat, soaked and weary. Jeff didn't complain. Rather, he fawned on Jelen for his attention. He had never behaved so with their father. Her father had always been distant and gruff, with both his son and daughter. Perhaps her own father had not been affectionate, but, simple or not, it was wrong for Jeff to forget him so soon.
Likely their father wasn't even dead yet. Tora seethed in silence. But worse came the next night. Her mother had made a fish stew, more like a soup, for she had stretched it to feed all of them. It was thin and grey, made from small fish caught from shore, and the starchy roots of the brown lily that grew on the cliffs, and kelp, and small shellfish from the beach. It tasted like low tide smelled. They had to eat in shifts, for there were not enough bowls. Tora and her mother ate last, with Tora given a small serving, and her mother scraping out the kettle for her dinner. As Tora slowly spooned up the thin broth and small pieces of fish and root, Jelen sat down heavily across from her.
"Things have to change," he said abruptly,
and her mother gaped silently. Tora gave him a flat look. He was staring at her, not her mother.
"It's plain to see there's not enough in this house to go around. Not food, not beds, not room. So, either we have to find a way to create more of those things, or we have to ask some people to move out."
Her mother was silent, gripping the edge of the table with both hands. Tora gave her a sideways glance. Her eyes were anxious, her mouth pinched tight as a drawstring poke. She'd get no help there. Her father taken less than 5 days ago, and her mother already abandoning her. She met Jelen's gaze, and she was proud her voice didn't shake, as she said, "You're talking about me." He nodded once.
"It's plain to see that caring for little Cordell doesn't suit you, or him. You stand your watches for the village, but that doesn't put more food in the house or more firewood on the stack. You step over a chore that plainly needs doing, and what we ask you to do, you do grudgingly. You spend most of each day sulking by the fire."
A coldness was running through her as he recounted her faults. It made her ears ring. Her mother's silence was condemnation. Her brother stood away from the table, looking down, shamed for her. Frightened, perhaps. They both felt Jelen was justified. They'd both surrendered their family loyalty to Jelen at the moment that they gave him her father's sword. He was talking on and on, suggesting that she could go with some of the people who were scavenging the beaches at low tide for tiny shellfish. Or that she might walk for 4 hours to Sheerton to see if she could find work there, something she could do for a few coins a day to bring some food into the house. She made no reply to any of his words, nor did she let her face change expression. When he finally stopped talking, she spoke. "I thought our room and board here were well paid for in advance. Did you not take my father's sword in its fine leather sheath, tooled with the words of my family's motto? Follow a strong man, it says. That's a fine sword Buckheap made. My father bore it in his days in King Shrewd's guard, when he was young and hearty. Now you have the sword that was to be my inheritance." "Tora," her mother gasped. But it was a remonstrance for her, not a heart-stricken realization of what she had given away.
"Ungrateful bitch!" Jelen's wife gasped as he demanded. "Can you eat a sword, you stupid child? Can it keep the rain from your back or warm your feet when the snow falls?"
Tora had just opened her mouth to reply when they heard the scream. It was not distant. Someone pelted past the cottage, shrieking breathlessly. Tora was first to her feet, opening the door to peer out into the rainy night as Jelen and Dada shouted, "Close the door and bar it!" As if they had learned nothing from the folk who had been burned to death when the raiders had torched their cottages.
"They're coming!" someone shouted. "They're coming from the beach! Out of the sea! They're coming!"
Her brother came crowding behind her to slip under her arm and peer out.
"They're coming," he said, in foolish approval.
A moment later the whistle sounded, two blasts, over
and over again.
Hell's balls, close that damn door!
Jelen roared. The sword he had so decried a moment before was bared in his hands now. The sight of it and the fine sheath discarded on the floor raised Tora's fury to white hot. She pushed past her brother, seized the edge of the door, and slammed it shut in his face. An instant later, she wished she had thought to take her cloak with her, but it was too fine of a defiant exit to spoil by going back for it. It was raining, not heavily, but in penetrating small insistent drops. Other folk were emerging from their homes to peer out into the night. Some few had seized their pathetic weapons, cudgels and fish knives and gaff hooks, tools of trades that were never intended for battle or defense, were all they had. A long scream rose and fell in the night. Most folk stayed within their doorways, but some few, the bold or the hopeless, ventured out. In a loose group they walked through the dark streets toward the whistle. One of the men carried a lantern. It showed Tora damaged homes, some burned to cinders, and others skeletons of blackened beams. She saw a dead dog that had not been cleared from the street. Perhaps his owner was no longer alive. Some homes stood relatively intact, light leaking from shuttered windows. She hated the smell the rain woke from the burned homes. Items that the raiders had claimed, then dropped, were scorched and sodden in the street. The scream was not repeated, and to Tora, that seemed more frightening than if it had gone on. The lantern bearer held it high, and by its uncertain light, Tora saw several figures coming toward them. One of the men in the group suddenly called out,
"Hatilda, you live!"
He ran toward a woman. She made no reply to his greeting. Instead, she abruptly stopped and stared at the rubble of a home. Slowly Tora and the others approached them. The man stood beside Hatilda, a questioning look on his face. Her hair was lank, her wet clothes hung limp on her. He spoke gently to her. "They burned your cottage. I'm so sorry, Hatilda." Without a word, she turned from him. The house next to her rubble had survived the attack. She walked to it and tried the door, and then pounded on it. An elderly woman opened it slowly.
"Hatilda! You survived!" she exclaimed.
A tentative smile began to form on her face. But the forged woman said nothing. She pushed the old woman out of her way and entered the cottage. The old woman stumbled after her. From within, Tora heard her querulous cry of,
"Please don't eat that! It's all I have for my grandson!"
Before Tora could wonder about that, a woman came running down the street toward them. She shrieked in terror as she passed two plodding silhouettes. Then, as she saw the huddled group, she sobbed out,
"Help me! Help me! He raped me! My own brother raped me!"
"Oh, Deli!" a man in Tora's group cried out, and doffed his cloak to offer it to cover her torn garments. She accepted it, but shrank back from his touch.
"Roth, is that you?"
the lantern bearer asked, as a tall man strode out of the darkness toward them. The man was bare-chested and barefoot, his skin bright red with cold. He made no response, but abruptly knocked a young man in the group to his knees. He tore the cloak from the youngster's shoulders, half-choking him in the process. He wrapped himself in it, glared at the gawkers, then turned and stalked toward a house.
"That's not your house, Roth!"
the lantern bearer cried, as others helped the shaken lad to his feet. They huddled ever closer together, like sheep circled by wolves. Roth did not pause. He tried the door and found it latched. He backed up two steps, and then, with a roar, he charged the door and kicked it hard. It flew open. From within came angry shouts and a shriek. Tora stood open-mouthed as Roth walked in.
"Roth?"
asked a man's voice, and moments later, the sounds of a fight filled the night.
Several of the men moved purposefully toward the door. A woman carrying a small child ran out toward them, crying,
"Help! Help! He's killing my husband! Help!"
As two men ran in, Tora stood still in the darkened street. This is what he meant, she informed herself quietly. He'd been right. She'd thought the king's man had been mad, but he'd been right. Into the street stumbled Hatilda and the old woman. They were locked in fierce battle, while a small child stood in the doorway and wailed his terror. Some folk sprang to separate them, while others went to drag out Roth. In the midst of the shouting and the struggling fighters, Tora looked down the street and saw by the light of the open doorways more forged ones coming. Folk opened their doors, peered out, and slammed them again. Dread and hope warred in her. Would she see her father's silhouette among them? But he was not there. The youngster whose cloak Roth had stolen leaped onto his back when the other men dragged him out of the cottage. He wrapped an arm around Roth's neck, shouting, "I want my cloak back!" Another man tried to pull him off Roth, while three others fought to detain Roth as someone shouted, "Roth, give up, Roth! Let us help you! Roth, stop fighting us!" But he didn't stop, and while his opponents attempted only to restrain him, he struck out with full force, as pleased to kill them as to drive them off. Tora saw the moment when the other men lost all their restraint. Roth was borne to the ground under the weight of the other fighters. The one man pleaded for Roth to give up, but the others were cursing and hitting and kicking Roth. But Roth kept fighting. A savage kick to his head ended it, and Tora cried out as she saw Roth's neck snap and his ear touch his shoulder. Abruptly, he was still. Two more kicks from different men. Then, like rebuked dogs, they were suddenly, silently, stepping back from his body. In the street, the man who had first greeted Hatilda still gripped her from behind, pinning her arms to her side. The old woman was sitting up in the street, weeping and wailing. Hatilda was flinging her head back, her teeth snapping wildly and kicking her bare heels into the man's legs. Tora had a flash of insight. The raiders had deliberately released them cold and hungry and soulless, so they would immediately have reasons to attack their families and neighbors. Was this why they had burned only half the village? Was it so that those who remained would know the fury of their own people? But there was no quiet moment to mull over that thought.
"Sweet Ida!"
a man shouted some distance away, and Roth's friend cried out,
"You've killed him! Roth! Roth! He's dead! He's dead!"
"Hatilda, stop it! Stop it!"
But Roth was sprawled on the ground, his tongue thrust out of his bloody mouth, and Hatilda went on silently snapping, struggling and kicking. And in that moment of shocked unsilence, Tora heard the cries, the crashes, the shrieks, and the furious roars from elsewhere in the village. Someone was blowing a whistle, desperately, over and over. Their folk had come back, forged as King Shrewd's messenger had warned them they would be. But now Tora knew what it meant. They would indeed take anything they wanted or needed. And some, like Roth, would not be stopped by anything short of death. The villagers would kill her father. Tora abruptly knew that. Her father was a strong and stubborn man, the strongest man she'd ever known. He would not stop until he had what he needed. The only way to stop him from taking what he needed would be to kill him. Papa. Where would he be? Which way would he come? The whistles and shouts and screams were coming from every direction. The forged were returning, and it was worse than the night the raiders had come, setting fires and stealing and raping and killing. That attack had been a shock. But they had known their folk would return. Their dreads and hopes had risen and fallen. And now, just when the villagers had begun to resume their lives, to rebuild houses and pull the boats ashore to repair them. The raiders struck again, with their own folk as weapons, with her father as their attacker. Where would he be? And she knew. He would go home. Tora ran through the dark streets. Twice she dodged forged ones. She knew them even in the dim light leaking from shuttered windows. They walked stiff and cold, as if puzzled at being thrust back into a life they had once shared. She ran past Jend Greenoak, kneeling in the streets and sobbing,
"But the baby! Where is our baby?"
Tora slowed her steps and stared unwillingly. Jen's wife, Salal, stood in the street, her garments still dripping seawater, her arms empty of the babe she had carried off to the red ship. She stared at the burned rubble of their home. She spoke harshly.
"I'm cold and hungry. The baby did nothing but cry. It was useless."
Her words carried no emotion, not regret, nor anger. She stated her truth. Jend swayed where he knelt, and she walked away from him, her arms embracing herself against the cold as she strode down the street toward a lit cottage. Tora knew what would come next. But the woman who stepped out of the cottage held a cudgel and called over her shoulder,
"Bar the door! Open for no one but me!"
Nor did the woman wait for Salal to try to enter. She strode forward to meet her, cudgel swinging. Salal did not retreat. Instead, she voiced her fury at being thwarted with an inhuman shriek and ran at the woman, her hands lifted to claw.
"No!"
shouted Jend, and found his feet to rush to his wife's defense. So it would go, Tora suddenly knew. Some would stand with their loved ones, forged or not, and others would defend their homes at any cost. Jend took a smashing blow to his gut and went down in the street, but Salal fought on regardless of a dangling and crooked jaw. The defending woman was screaming wordlessly, turned just as savage as the forged one she fought. The men who had fought Roth were standing and shouting at one another. Tora dashed past them, powered by both horror and fear. She did not want to see another person die tonight.
"Stand with your family," her father had always told her. She remembered the day well. Someone had cursed Jeff for dashing into the street, entranced by a flock of geese flying overhead.
"Keep your half-wit boy tethered to your porch,"
the teamster had shouted at them. He'd had to rein in sharply, and his slippery load of fresh fish had nearly slewed out of his cart. Papa had dragged him down from the seat of his cart and thrashed him in the street. No matter how her father might shun his simple son within the walls of his own home, in public, he defended him. Her mother had echoed those words when her father came in with his bloodied knuckles and blackened eyes.
"We always stand with our blood," she'd told Tora.
Then, Tora had not doubted that she meant it. Perhaps tonight, her mother would recall where her loyalties should be. Tora was out of breath. She trotted rather than ran now, but her thoughts raced far ahead of her destination. She could well be on the path back to her old life. She would find her father, and he would know her. She would warn him, protect him from villagers who might not understand. Even if he never showed affection for any of them again, he would still be Papa, and her family would be together again. She would rather sleep on cold earth with her family than sleep on the floor by the fire in Jelen's house. She ran past Jelen's house and on, past the partially burned homes, away from the dim light that leaked from windows. This part of the village was dead. It stank of burned wood and burned flesh. She had lived in the same house all her life, but in all the destruction, she was suddenly not sure which burned wreckage had been their home. thin moonlight reached down and glinted faintly only on wet wood and stone. She trotted through a foreign landscape, a place she had never been before. Everything she had ever known was gone. She almost crashed into her father before she saw him. He was standing motionless, staring at where their house had been. She recoiled, then stood still. He turned slowly toward her, and for an instant, the moonlight glinted in his eyes. Then darkness claimed his face again. He said nothing.
Papa?
She said. He didn't respond. The words vomited from her.
They burned the house. We saw them take you away. Your head was bloody. Mother told me to run and hide. She went to find Jeff. I hid high in the old willow that overlooks the harbor. They took you out to their ship. What did they do to you? Did they hurt you?
He was very still. Then he shook his head, a small, quick shake, as if a mosquito had buzzed in his ear. He walked past her toward the dimly lit part of the village that still stood. She hesitated, then hurried after him.
Papa, the others in the village know you were taken. A man came from the king. He told the village to defend themselves against forged ones, to kill them if we had to.
Her father kept walking.
Are you forged, Papa? Did they do something to you?
He kept walking.
Papa, do you know me?
His steps slowed.
You're Tora, and you talk too much.
After he'd spoken, he resumed his pace.
It was all she could do to keep from dancing after him. He knew her. He had always mocked and teased her that she was such a talker. His voice was flat, but he was cold and wet, hungry and tired. But he knew her. She hugged herself against the cold and hurried after him. Papa, you have to listen to me. I've seen them killing some of the others who were kidnapped. We have to be careful. And you need a weapon. You need your sword.
For 5 steps he kept his pace. Then he said,
I need my sword.
It's at Jelen's house. Mother and Jeff and I have been staying there, sleeping on their floor. Mother gave him your sword to let us stay with him. He said he might need it to protect his wife and baby.
She had a stitch in her side from all the running, and despite hugging herself, the cold was seeping into her bones. Her mouth was dry, but she pushed all that to one side.
Once Papa was inside the house with his sword, he'd be safe. They'd all be safe again.
Her father turned toward the first lit house.
No, not there. They'll try to kill you. First, we have to get your sword. Then you can get warm and have some food, or a hot drink.
Now that she thought of it, there was probably no food left, but there would be tea, and perhaps a bit of bread. Better than nothing, she told herself. He was walking on. She dashed ahead of him.
Follow me,
she told him. A piercing scream rang out in the night, but it was distant, not nearby. She ignored it, as she had ignored the angry shouts that came and went. She did not slacken her pace, but walked backwards hastily, motioning for him to follow her. He came on doggedly. They reached Jelen's cottage. She ran up to the door and tried to open it. It was barred. She banged on it with her fists.
Let me in! Open the door! She cried.
Inside, her mother lifted her voice.
Oh, thank Ida. It's Tora. She's come back. Please, Jelen. Please, let her in.
A silence. Then she heard the bar lifted from its supports. She seized the handle and pulled the door open just as her father came up behind her.
Mother, I've found Papa. I've brought him home, she cried.
Her mother stood in the door. She looked at Tora, then at her husband. A terrible hope lit in her eyes.
Burke,
her mother said, her voice cracking on his name.
Papa?
Jeff's voice was both questioning and fearful. Jelen pushed them both to one side. Papa's sword was naked in his hand. He lifted it and pointed it at Papa.
Get back,
he said in a low and deadly voice. His gaze flickered to Tora.
You stupid little bitch. Get in here and get behind me.
No. It wasn't just that it called her a bitch. It was the way he held the blade, unwavering toward her father. Jelen wasn't even going to give him a chance. Let us in. Let Papa in. Let him get warm and have some food. That's what he needs. It's all that any of the Forged Ones need. And I think, if we give it to them, they'll have no reason to hurt us. At Jelen's flat stare, she grew desperate. Mother, tell him to let us both in. This is our chance to be a family again. The words tumbled from her mouth. She stepped, not quite in front of Papa, but closer to him, to show Jelen that he'd have to stab her before he could fight Papa. She wasn't forged. He had no excuse to stab her. Papa spoke behind her.
That is my sword!
Anger rose in his voice on that last word.
Get inside, Tora. Now!
Jelen shifted his stare to her father. He spoke sternly.
Burke, I've no wish to hurt you. Go away!
Back inside the cottage, the baby started crying. Jelen's wife began to sob.
Make him go away, Jelen. Drive him off. And her with him. She's nothing but trouble. Oh, sweet Ida, mercy on me and my child. Drive him away. Kill him!
Dada's voice was rising to hysteria, and Tora could see in Jelen's eyes that he was listening to her. Maybe he would stab her. Her voice rose to shrill, despite herself.
Mother, will you let him kill both of us? With Papa's own sword?
Tora, get inside. Your father is not himself. Her mother's voice shook. She had hugged Jeff to her side. He was sob-panting, his prelude to one of his total panics. Soon he would race in circles, sobbing and shrieking.
Mother, please, Tora begged.
Then her father seized her by the back of her neck and her shirt collar. He flung her into the cottage. She collided with Jelen, then fell at his feet. He was off balance and flailing when Papa reached in, past the tip of his own sword, to seize Jelen's wrist. Tora knew that clamping grip. She'd seen him haul big halibut up off the bottom, his hand seized tight on the line. In a moment it happened as she knew it would. Jelen gave a cry, and the sword fell from his nerveless hand. It was right next to her. She seized the hilt and scrabbled back into the room.
Papa, I've got it. I've got your sword for you.
Papa said nothing. He had not released his grip on Jelen's wrist. Jelen was shouting and cursing and fighting Papa's one hand, as if by breaking that grip he could win. Her father's lips were pulled back from his set teeth. His eyes were empty. Jelen put all his efforts into pulling away. But Papa jerked the smaller man toward him. His free hand went to Jelen's throat. He caught him there, his big hand right under Jelen's jaw. He squeezed and then abruptly released Jelen's wrist and put both hands on his neck. He lifted Jelen up on his toes, and Papa's eyes were very intent, his mouth flat as he throttled the man. He tilted his head to one side and regarded Jelen's darkening face with intent interest.
No!
Shrieked Dada, but she did nothing but retreat into the corner clutching her child. Jeff seized two handfuls of his own hair and wailed loudly as he shook his own head. Tora's mother was the one who charged in. She seized one of Papa's thick arms and tugged at it. She hung her weight from it, as if she swung from a tree branch.
Burke, no! No, let him go! Burke, Don't kill him. He was kind to us. He gave us shelter. Burke, stop!
But Papa did not stop. Jelen's eyes were wide, his mouth open. He had been clutching at Papa's hands, but now his hands fell away to hang limply at his sides. As Papa shook him, Tara looked down at the sword in her hands. She lifted it in a two-handed grip, unsure of what she was going to do. She was shaking, and the sword was heavy. She braced her feet and squared her shoulders and steadied the blade just as Papa dropped a floppy Jelen to the floor. He looked at his wife, still clinging to his arm. He snapped his arm straight, flinging her aside. And she flew backwards and onto the sword. Tora dropped the blade as her mother crashed into it. It stuck, sank, then fell away as her mother tumbled down. Papa took two steps forward and backhanded Jeff. The blow drove him to the floor.
Quiet!
He roared at his idiot son. And for a wonder, Jeff obeyed. Jeff drew his knees tight to his chest and clapped both hands over his bleeding mouth as he looked up in terror at his father. The command almost silenced Darda as well. Jelen's wife had one hand clapped over her own mouth, and with the other she held Cordell tight to her body, muffling his cries.
Food!
Papa commanded. He moved toward the fire and held out his hands to the warmth. Jelen did not move. Tora's mother sat up, moaning and clutching her ribs. Tora looked down at the sword on the floor.
Food!
Her father said again. He glared round at them all, and his eyes made no distinction between his own bleeding wife and Jelen's cowering one. Neither spoke nor stirred, and Jeff, as always, was useless. Tara found her tongue.
Papa, please, sit down. I'll see what I can find for you, she told him,
and went to Darda's larder. The raiders had not burned Jelen's home, but had looted any foodstuffs they could find. She doubted she would find much on the shelves. In a wooden box, Tora found half a loaf of bread. That was all. But as she pulled the box down to get the bread, she saw something hidden behind the box. A clean cloth wrapped several sides of dry fish and a big wedge of cheese. Her outrage rose as she pushed it aside to see a trove of potatoes in a bag, a pot of honey, and a pot of rendered lard. Dried apples at the very back of the shelf. A braid of garlic. Darda had hidden all that rich food and forced them to exist on thin soup.
You were holding the good food back from us, she accused Darda, speaking toward the cupboard in a low voice.
She broke a piece from the cheese and crammed it into her mouth. Behind her, her father roared,
Now! I want food, now!
As Tora glanced over her shoulder, her father bared his teeth at her. His eyes were narrowed, and he made a threatening noise in his throat. Tora carried the bread, honey, and cheese to the table. He didn't wait for her to set it out nicely, but snatched the loaf in both his dirty hands. She dropped the cheese and set down the honey. She backed away from the table. She spared a sideways glance for Darda and spoke in a low voice.
Mother, they were cheating us. Jelen said there wasn't enough to go around, but Darda hid food from us.
Darda's voice shook with fear and defiance.
It was our food before all this happened. We didn't owe it to you. It was food for my boy. He needs it to grow. Jelen and I weren't eating it. It was food for Cordell.
Her father appeared to hear none of this. He had lifted the loaf to his mouth and was worrying a tremendous bite from it. Around that mouthful he yelled,
Drink! Something to drink! I am thirsty!
Water was what there was, and Tora filled a mug with it and took it to him. Her mother had risen, staggered, then folded up to huddle by Jeff. Her idiot brother was rocking back and forth. Instead of seeing to her own wound, her mother was trying to calm him. Tora took the cloth that had wrapped the loaf and went to her. "Let me see your wound," she said, as she crouched down beside her. Her mother's eyes flashed dark fire. "Get away from me," she cried, and pushed Tora so she sprawled on the floor. But she did snatch up the cloth and hold it to her ribs. It reddened with blood, but only slightly. Tora guessed that the blade had sliced her, but not deeply. She was still appalled. "I'm sorry," she said stiffly. "I didn't mean to hurt you. I didn't know what to do." "You did know. You just didn't want to do it, as is ever your way." "Family first," she cried out. "You and Papa always said that. Family first." "Does he look like he is thinking of his family?" her mother demanded. Tora looked over at her father. The cheese was almost gone. He had pushed a piece of bread into the pot of honey and was wiping it clean of sweetness. As she watched, he shoved it into his mouth. The discarded honey pot rolled to the edge of the table and fell to the floor with a crash. Her mother levered herself to her feet, leaning on Jeff's shoulder. "Get up, boy," she said quietly, tugging on him, and he rose. She took his hand and led him back to where Dada and Jelen's son huddled. "Stay there," she warned him, and he sank down on his haunches beside them. Clutching her side, she stood between them and her husband. Tora got slowly to her feet. She backed to the wall and looked from her father to her mother. The fire crackled, and Papa ate noisily, tearing at the bread with bared teeth. Rain and wind came in the open door. In the distance, people still shouted. Dada clutched her baby and sobbed into him, and Jeff made his babyish crooning in sympathy. Jelen was silent. Dead. Tora crept closer to the table. "Papa?" she said. His eyes turned toward her, then back to the bread. He tore off another mouthful. "Family first, Papa. Isn't that right? Shouldn't we stay together? To fix our house and raise our boat?" His gaze roved around the room, and her hopes rose that he would speak. "More food." That was his response. His eyes had a glitter in them she had never seen, as if they were shallow now, like puddles in the sun. Nothing behind them. "There isn't any," she lied. He narrowed his eyes at her and showed his teeth. Her breath caught in her throat. Papa crammed the last of the bread into his mouth. He stuffed the cheese in after it. He rocked from side to side in the chair as he chewed it, then stood. She backed away from him. He picked up the mug, drank the last of the water, and dropped it. "Papa?" Tora begged him. He looked past her. He walked to the couple's bed. He took Jelen's extra shirt from its peg on the wall. He put it on. It was too small for him. Jelen's wool cap fit him well. He peered around the cottage. Jelen's winter cloak was on a hook beside the door. He took that, too. He swung it round his shoulders. Then he rounded to look at her accusingly. "Please, Papa." Could not he be who he had been, just for a time? Even if he cared nothing for them, as the bastard had said, could not he be the man who always knew what they must do next to survive? "More food?" He scratched his face, his blunt nails making a sound in his short beard. His gaze was flat. That was all he said. He was thinking only of what he needed now. Nothing for what tomorrow might bring. Nothing for where he had been, what had happened to him, what had befallen the village. "You ate it all," Tora lied quietly. She scarcely knew why she did so. Papa gave a grunt. He nudged at Jelen's body, and when he didn't move, he stepped over it to stand in the open door. his head turned slowly from side to side. He took one step out the door and stopped. His sword was still on the floor. Not far from it, the sheath lay as well. She heard her mother's breathed prayer. "Sweet Ida, make him go away." He walked out into the night. The other villagers would kill him. They would kill him, and they would hate Tora forever because she hadn't killed him, because she had let him kill Jelen. Dada would not be silent about that. She would tell everyone. Tora looked over at her mother. She'd taken a heavy iron pan from the cooking shelf. She held it by the handle as if it were a weapon. Her eyes were flat as she stared at Tora. Yes, even her mother would hate her. Tora stooped to pick up the sword. It was still too heavy for her. The point of it dragged on the floor as she reached for the sheath. "Follow a strong man," the carved lettering told her. She shook her head. She knew what she should do. She should close the door behind Papa and bar it. She should say she was sorry 100, 1,000 times. She should bind Mother's wound and help Dada compose her husband's body. She should take Papa's sword and stand in the door and guard them all. She was the last person they had who might stand between them and the Forged Ones roaming the streets. She knew what she should do, but her mother was right about her. Tara looked back at them all, then took Dada's cloak from the hook. She put it on and pulled the thick wool hood up over her damp hair. She heaved the sword up so it rested on her shoulder like a shovel. She stooped and took up the fine sheath in her free hand.
"What are you doing?"
her mother demanded in outrage. Tora held out the sheath toward her. "Following a strong man," she said. She stepped out into the wind and rain. She kicked the door shut behind her. A moment longer she stood in the scant shelter of the eaves. She heard the bar slam down into the supports on the door. Almost immediately, Dada began shrieking, anger and grief in furious words. Tora stepped out into the night. Her father had not gone far. His hunched shoulders and stalking stride reminded her of a prowling bear as he moved through the rain toward his prey. A decision came to her. She pushed the empty sheath through her belt and gripped the sword's hilt in both hands. She considered it. If she killed him, would her mother forgive her? Would Dada? Not likely. She ran after him, the bared sword heavy and jouncing with every step she took.
"Papa, wait! You'll need your sword," she called after him.
He glanced back at her, but said nothing as he halted. But he waited for her. When she caught up with him, he walked on. She followed him into the darkness.
Ken Liu is an author and translator of speculative fiction, as well as a lawyer and programmer. His fiction has appeared in The Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, Asimov's Science Fiction, Analog, Clark's World, Lightspeed, and Strange Horizons, among many other places. He has won a Nebula, 2 Hugos, a World Fantasy Award, and a Science Fiction and Fantasy Translation Award, and been nominated for the Sturgeon and the Locus Awards. In 2015, he published his first novel, The Grace of Kings. His most recent books are The Wall of Storms, a sequel to The Grace of Kings, a collection, The Paper Menagerie and Other Stories, and, as editor and translator, an anthology of Chinese science fiction stories, Invisible Planets. He lives with his family near Boston, Massachusetts. Here, a young girl pressed into service as an assassin faces one final test of her skills. if she lives through it.
The Hidden Girl by Ken Liu. Beginning in the 8th century, the imperial court of Tang Dynasty China increasingly relied on military governors, the Jidushi, whose responsibilities began with border defense, but gradually encompassed taxation, civil administration, and other aspects of political power. They were, in fact, independent feudal warlords whose accountability to imperial authority was nominal. Rivalry among the governors was often violent and bloody. On the morning after my 10th birthday, spring sunlight dapples the stone slabs of the road in front of our house, through the blooming branches of the pagoda tree. I climb out onto the thick bough, pointing west like an immortal's arm, and reach for a strand of yellow flowers, anticipating the sweet taste tinged with a touch of bitterness. Alms, young mistress. I look down and see a bhikkhuni. I can't tell how old she is. Her face is unlined, but there is a fortitude in her dark eyes that reminds me of my grandmother. The light fuzz over her shaved head glows in the warm sun, like a halo, and her gray kasaya is clean but tattered at the hem. She holds up a wooden bowl in her left hand, gazing up at me expectantly. Would you like some pagoda tree flowers? I ask. She smiles. I haven't had any since I was a young girl. It would be a delight. If you stand below me, I'll drop some into your bowl, I say, reaching for the silk pouch on my back. She shakes her head. I can't eat flowers that have been touched by another hand, too infected with the mundane concerns of this dusty world. Then climb up yourself, I say. Immediately, I feel ashamed at my annoyance. If I get them myself, they wouldn't be alms now, would they? There's a hint